Hey, Project Big Screen listeners, you can find us every Monday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Academy Award winner J.K. Simmons stars in the new MGM Plus original series, The Westies.
There it is, Javits Center.
Biggest construction project in the history of New York falls into the lap of the Irish.
This Irish crime gang built New York City on blood, sweat, and loyalty. Their legend is true.
The Italians outnumber us about 100 to 1.
Their story is criminal.
This Irish guy's threatening war.
He's gotta go.
Keep out of Hell's Kitchen.
The Westies. Watch now. Only on MGM Plus.
Dedication isn't born in the light of day. It's carved in the quiet hours before the world blinks awake. At Boar's Head, we rise with a mission. To deliver craftsmanship worthy of your table. A slice of something special, folded into every moment worth savoring. Because dedication means delivering only the very best. Boar's Head, committed to craft since 1905.
In this first episode of Project Big Screen with myself, Jeff D. Lowe, Kirkman Ann, Ken Jack, Clemmer, and Gooch, we will have reviews of Leonardo DiCaprio and Paul Thomas Anderson's One Battle After Another, and then The Rock in The Smashing Machine is an Oscar-worthy performance. We'll have quick reviews on Mark Wahlberg's new streaming movie, Play Dirty, Daniel Day-Lewis's return to the big screen with Anemone, and a few other quick hit reviews, as well as our combined list and ranking of the top 10 movies of 2025 so far. Make sure to like and subscribe wherever you are watching or listening. Actually, no matter what, please give us a like and subscribe on YouTube, Apple Music, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all of that and more. All right, welcome on in to Project Big Screen, the first episode of our brand new movie podcast, wherever you're listening or watching, whether it be on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, if you're watching. Jeff D. Lowe alongside Kirk Minahan. I'm going down the list in front of me. Gooch, Clemmer, Ken Jack, brand new movie podcast coming at you. It's a movie review and rankings podcast. So we don't have to do like, you know, a back and forth on what it is, but very excited. I think the excitement level's high. Kirk, I think there's five of us here. We'll see how many there are in a week or two. Right?
Yeah. I'm not thrilled with the star here, if I'm being totally honest, behind the scenes. I don't like what's going on here.
Gucci in a wind tunnel. Yeah.
The horns are, but I'm sure it'll be good.
We have a great movie, I think, that we all pretty much like today, how it's going to work going forward. I'll quickly go over this. Two reviews off the top today. There'll be one or two, depending on how many movies come out this week. We're doing two because we want to catch up and talk one battle after another. We'll have a segment in between where we kind of do like a couple quick hits, like maybe movies or small things that we've seen that we're not going to do like full reviews on, but we'll give you our takes, maybe some movie news, trailer breakdowns, and then we'll do a list at the end every week, a combined list too. So we'll argue and disagree with each other. It's a top 10 list that we all get two picks each. Let's get right into it. One Battle After Another. Latest movie from Paul Thomas Anderson. Bob, a washed up revolutionary who lives in a state of stoned paranoia, surviving off-grid and with his spirit and self-reliant daughter, Willa. When his evil nemesis resurfaces and Willa goes missing, the former radical scrambles to find her as both father and daughter battle the consequences of their past. 2 hours, 50 minutes, like I said, from PTA, based on the 1990 book Vineland, which based on is a heavy, heavy word in that. I didn't read it, what I've been told, it's not too much like the book. Leonardo DiCaprio, Sean Penn, Benicio del Toro, Chase Infinity, Tiana Taylor. In the movie, it's made $79 million as of when we're recording this on October 5th. 95% are on Tomatoes, IMDb 8.4, Metacritic 95, Letterboxd 4.4. Kirk, we'll start with you. Then we'll go to Ken Jack, Gooch, Clemmer, then myself. You're a big PTA guy. Mm-hmm. Give our scores off the top. By the way, you can see at the bottom if you're watching on YouTube, our Letterboxd. Kirk just joined Letterboxd. You can see our Letterboxd names for longer reviews as well. If you're listening, it's in the description below. So, Kirk, quick thoughts off the top of what'd you give One Battle After Another?
I think I gave it a 92. Is that right? I think it was somewhere in the low 90s. It was either 92 or 94, put it that way. I think it was a 92. I have it fourth PTA movies, which is, you know, no small thing. There Will Be Blood, Boogie Nights, The Master, and this. Great. Like, you know, the first 30, 40 minutes maybe or so, I was kind of not sure where we were going. And then for me, this first scene with Penn and Tony Goldwyn and those guys in that room, I thought, well, here we go. This is a movie I haven't seen before. And then we're off to the races. I mean, It's not my favorite movie of the year, but loved it. Great. I'll be curious how it plays come Oscar time. But my expectations were met. My expectations were high. So for me, right now, definitely top five movie of the year and top five PTA movie, which is, you know, pretty good. So yeah, very pleased. Very pleased.
Yeah, we'll hit a couple of those things you just mentioned. We'll definitely hit them. Like, we'll do some like big questions for the movie. We'll definitely talk Oscars in a second. We'll definitely talk where we rank it. Ken Jack, what about you? Are you on board in the 90s with one battle after another?
Yeah, I think it is kind of crazy thinking with PTA where like his fifth best movie could be almost any other director on the planet's number one with a bullet.
Sure.
Like, no question. And I think I loved pretty much everything he was able to do in it. Like, it's perfectly placed. It's exciting. It's organically funny, which I think is kind of hard to get across in movies now. And I think the performances you get out of every member of this cast is extraordinary. Like, you get one of the best performances from Sean Penn. You get really concentrated punches out of Regina Hall, out of Goldwyn, out of like Schwieg, the Native American tracker guy, crazy. And that dude, fucking, we'll talk about him more later as well. James Ratterman, the interrogator guy, like get all these crazy, super concentrated punches of really strong acting across the board. Super impressed by it. I'm at like a 93 out of 100. I'd have it like right around, I think maybe a little bit higher than you could, like the third best PTA, where like it's the same thing. It's like Boogie Nights. It's There Will Be Blood, Boogie Nights. And then probably I'd have Master in this like somewhere around the same. And I'd have the same, I guess, sort of criticism as you, where like that first 20-30, you're like, okay, what's the thought process here? But yeah, once it picks up, it really picks up.
92, 93, Gooch, are we going higher?
I'm five stars, so that could mean 100, 10 out of 10, whatever formula you want to use to get there. But
you're
going to
put a number on it.
100 out of 100, though.
All right, great. There it is. Great, great.
There you go. Hey,
what else would 5 out of 5 stars mean?
Yeah,
other than 100 out of 100?
Well, I don't know, because on Letterboxd, like, if you give a movie like an 80, it's like 4 stars. I don't know. Like, I'm baffled by this.
Yeah, there's.
I don't know, Gooch. Yeah.
The scale, Clemmer asked the other day about like scale and how we're going to do it. Our numbers will be very interesting and differing. This is different because this is a movie that it seems like we all like, unless Clemmer's about to drop like a 70 on it. But it is going to be interesting, like going forward, like there'll be a couple where it's going to be this huge difference in what we rate it. But yeah. Okay. 5 stars. Yeah. Big.
Yeah. I'm at 100 out of 100. It joins 3 other Paul Thomas Anderson movies that I have rated 5 out of 5. Best of the year. I think so. Best of the century. That's a very tough label to put on to any movie, but I do think it's in the class of movies that you could claim that for. Just fantastic stuff all around. You guys will talk more in detail about, you know, the performances, the score we're going to get into here in a minute. But the one thing I do want to highlight is just the pacing on this movie is just fucking insane. 2 hours and 50 minutes feels like, I mean, an hour and a half.
Agreed.
Once you get past that first act, I mean, this thing just zips and chugs along. Just brilliant stuff.
It's one of the quickest 3 hours I've ever sat in a movie theater.
That's like, a great point. I saw a movie today that was 2 hours and it felt like it was 20 hours.
Oh, we'll get to that.
And
oh,
yeah, I know we will. But you're right. For like, Gooch is exactly right. That movie felt like, I don't know, an hour 30, like an hour 40. Oh, it's true.
Clemmer, last one. Where do you have it?
I love this. I have this as a 92. Echo everything everybody said. I mean, especially like some of those other performances, like Regina Hall or The Interrogator, or especially Tony Goldwyn. Those just stood out for me. And the stuff Regina Hall is even doing with her eyes is incredible. Like, she's just such a great actress. And obviously, she can do comedy, but she proves she can do so much more here. As far as P.T. Anderson, I don't know, man. I think I might expect my second favorite movie of his. I love Phantom Thread. And I really appreciate some of the stuff in Magnolia. I wasn't a huge Master fan. Boogie Nights, to me, is a clear number one. So I don't have this as, like, 100 of 100. This isn't, like, a five-star movie for me. But it's in that next tier. It's one of the top 10 movies of the decade for anybody. It's one of my 3 favorite movies of the year. This is fantastic. And it's, I don't know, I had such a blast. It was exciting. It was fun. It made me think. It made me sad. It made me happy. It brings everything you want from a movie. It's awesome.
Yeah, I'm at a 95. So everyone was at least a 92 or higher. Everyone with at least an A minus. That's how you grade things. I thought this was excellent. There's not even really much more I can say based on what everyone else said. Paced great. Thrilling score, great acting, and I guess we'll lead right into it. I mean, again, is there much more to say after I say give it a 95? I agree with everyone said, so why don't we just go into one of the biggest parts about it? We won't spoil it right this second, just a heads up. We will know when we're going to spoil it. I think the big question is, whose movie is this? Because 2 weeks ago before you saw this, would you have said Leo? And now do you say Sean Penn? Because, like, for me – he might be on the poster. I'll start with you, Clemmer, because we had you go last there just now. Is this Sean Penn's movie? And also, should he be a lock to win Best Supporting Actor?
So, I think I'm the only person that feels this way. I didn't love the Sean Penn performance.
Oh, my God, Clemmer. What the fuck is wrong with you?
It was too broad.
How far into it are I don't want to participate in this.
It was too broad. I loved the Tony Gwynn level of evil.
Tony Gwynn was not in the film. Tony Gwynn was not in the film. I don't think he was in the film.
He would have been great, though.
He was in Hard Eight. That was the only one he was in.
I love Tony Goldwyn's level of evil, that sliminess. I love the interrogator. To me, it was just a little too broad. Now, Fights had the same take, saw it again, and said, no, the second time, I see it. And Kirk, I know we talked about it. You said he needs to be that broad.
Of course, like, that's an over-the-top role. That's an over-the-top crazed role. It's the best supporting performance down,
what
this decade.
What the fuck would have happened?
Yeah, well, he's supposed to be muted? Like, what do you – I mean, this is a crazy role.
So here's kind of the pushback on that is that so much – the Del Toro character is wild and out there. And obviously DiCaprio is kind of out there. But I feel like some of the other evil characters were a bit more grounded. It did take me out of the movie a couple of times. It was just so ridiculous. But I haven't done a second viewing this yet. And I do appreciate, like, every single person I've talked to besides myself feels a certain way. So I'm like, all right, I might just be wrong about this. And the rest of the movie is so brilliant. But for me, it was just a little too big. So for me, it wasn't one of the best supporting actor roles I've seen this year. But in fairness, I could be wrong.
I actually felt like Del Toro is kind of understated, honestly, from what I expected from the trailer and stuff going. To me, it's the best. It's his movie. And we haven't mentioned Leonardo DiCaprio yet. I give him credit. Like, in the middle of his career, he's like, I'm just going to play another dummy, play it well. And, like, this is Sean Penn's movie. It's the best supporting performance of this decade, I think. I don't even know what else I would put up against it. You guys probably have better names than I would, but I can't think of anything.
You wouldn't put your favorite supporting performance up there, Jamie Lee Curtis from Everything Everywhere All At Once?
That was pretty good. That was a tremendous performance. Yeah, that was really great. That was really great.
Not even. I saw your review, Ken Jack. I know you're on the Sean Penn side of the aisle here.
Yeah, no, big time. I was super impressed by it. And I feel like you see, like, not that I know, like, some giant fucking grouping of, like, old grizzled vets, but, like, the very few that I know, and, like, old cops and stuff, they carry themselves in that same sort of way. Like, that little, like, waddle and stuff, and that, like, the way he talked and those little facial contortions he would make, like the twitches, I loved it. And I like his, like, character, the overtopness of it, like, kind of being complimented by his, like, insecurity, because he's so, like, desperate to not be a pawn and to be, like, one of the bigger players. And that's what I like with, like, Tony Goldwyn and, like, the rest of the Christmas Club or whatever. They're, like, clearly the more in control, like, sure of themselves, like, top dogs. And Penn is so desperate to be one of those that it literally throws his whole life apart. And I loved it. I thought he was awesome in that. I feel like I haven't seen him in a movie in like 100 years after I saw something like a performance like that. I was really impressed.
Speaking of that club, shout out to Jim Downey, who had a nice role in this movie.
He's back, baby. He's
funny because this like a younger generation probably just knows him from the Conan clip of the Jeffrey Epstein, the New York financier, which is like, so obviously like a younger generation may not know who he is, obviously how legendary he is, but it was cool to see him in this second one because he was in There Will Be Blood very briefly. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see where it stacks up, I guess. There's other ones, whether, you know, Clemmer's right or who other the rest of us are right in terms of like where he stands in the supporting, because there are other movies too. And actually, supporting this year, for the most part, the favorites, I'm looking at it right now, we haven't even seen the movies. Like, it's like Adam Sandler, Jay Kelly, Jeremy Strong with the Springsteen movie, which may end up being the death of two people on this show, that movie. Yeah, for sure. Paul Mescal, Hamnet, which has a ton of hype. I see Andrew after The Hunt, Andrew Garfield.
I got to think Delroy Lindo's getting nominated. He should.
I would hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Sinners has a second wind in it.
Yeah, for sure.
Because if you look on DraftKings right now, one bet off another is the only movie that isn't plus money to win the Oscars. It is the odds on favorite right now to win Best Picture. I've actually seen Benicio in a bunch of odds and rankings right now for supporting actor. It'd be cool. It's a cool, like you said, understated, kind of calm role, but like frantic at the same time. It's not what I expected from Benicio del Toro, because I expected like a big, like energetic, and it was the scene in his apartment where everyone's frantic and freaking out. He's just very calmly doing everything, but everything he's doing is like grabbing a massive gun. Like it's such a great scene.
Are we worried that if del Toro got a nomination, that would not worry, but would that split the vote? Would like would that hurt Penn's chances?
How much? I got a question. How much is really splitting into a thing these days?
Yeah, I haven't really bought into that. I think they'll just. I mean, I feel like Penn's going to win this. Like, I feel like it's almost over. Like, what was open the, and shut?
What was the vote split worry we had? We all had a couple years ago. We were worried that that shitty movie about the swimming movie that we were worried
with Annette Bening and Jodie Foster.
Naiad?
Yeah,
Naiad.
Terrible movie that was. Oh my god.
Everyone's like, oh no, nah. The vote split means Naiad's going to win.
You know who's in that, Clemmer?
Who's that?
Ken Caminiti was in that movie.
Oh, really? Yeah. 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 Nice to see those Padres get worse.
He's very good. Yeah, a lot of dead Padres pop up.
Was there any other standouts, Ken Jack, any other people that maybe stood out for you? I know people talking about Chase Infinity. She was, I thought, great in her role, too. A pretty important role, obviously, in the movie, and no one really ever seen her before. So that was pretty good, I thought.
So, like, we were in a hype up Tony Goldwyn a lot, and I know Clem, obviously, Clemmer's very... very eager to get to him, but the one that I think really stood out to me is that James Ratterman, who is a real military interrogator, first acting role ever. And I, watching that, I'm like, oh, I must have seen him in something. He's incredible. This guy's so good. He's like chilling the way he's talking to these kids. And I think he was really good. And I think that you can give a lot of credit to PTA for that too, to get like an amateur actor. Granted, he obviously is professional in that field. I was really, really impressed by that, and I thought that role was very complimentary to Sean Penn.
His line in one of the interrogations, I think, Gooch, I Won't See Your Thunder, you tweeted it, was a great line.
Oh, yeah. You almost had this all figured out, and then you fumbled the ball at the 90-yard line at a fucking stank-ass nunnery. No, he had so many lines like that, too, where it's like he's just close to being a normal human being, but he does not. He is very clearly not a part of our society. Like, he is a lizard in a human skin. Yeah, no, that was terrifying. And finding out that he was, working for the HSA for 30 years. That kind of comes as no surprise in how well he nailed that. I would also like to throw out an honorary MVP for Bruno. Or was that his name? What's up, fucking homie? The kid at the door.
Yeah, Bluto.
Bluto, that's what it all. Do I look like your parents?
My favorite scene with Leo. I thought he was... Like, where have you seen him? I think they might have asked him this. Someone might have asked us in a podcast interview I listened to recently. I forget who it was. Asked him, like, you haven't played, like, the older, washed up, like, dad. Like, they played, like, a father before, but not, like, and just him being his protective dad. It was just a great delivery. Yeah, it was very good.
God bless Leo, like, in his prime, like, taking roles like this, too. No one else does it. Like, you're not going to see him in Marvel stuff. You're not going to see him in Star Wars stuff. All that stuff is fine, but he's going to make these movies, work with his directors. He's not afraid to be ugly or stupid or overweight or get pushed around or let somebody else give a great supporting performance. Like, just, a quiet MVP of this. I mentioned everybody else, but like Leonardo DiCaprio is the lead actor in this movie. And it does kind of revolve around him, but yet he just kind of sits back and lets, 12 different people, steal the movie from at different times.
Score, pretty great. I think Gucci mentioned it really quickly. Frantic score. Accompanied, I think I have it number two. If I were to rank best scenes of the year, I think it's behind the music montage scene from Sinners, which is one of the best scenes I've ever seen. But the car chase scene in this movie is, which I guess we're waiting in spoiler territory. So if you haven't seen the movie, I would skip ahead at this point. But the music was probably at its best during that scene, which is an unreal scene, which again, you want to talk about fucking versatility. The fact that Paul Thomas Anderson can do what he does and make a Phantom Thread, then make a Licorice Pizza, and then make this like a car, as good of a car chase scene as we've seen in a movie in, I don't know, like name a better one in the last like five, like it's pretty fantastic and ends in a way that you wouldn't expect, like really subverts your expectations. So yeah, music was awesome. Awesome in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love that creeping piano too, as like you get into the Rolling Hills shot, which Clemmer, we talked about that, right? The Rolling Hills. Holy cow.
Oh, it's the iconic part of this movie. Like it's like I said, the kind of Sinners, you remember that music era scene, and this year, and you remember that. I'm glad you brought that up, Jeff, about like how amazing Paul Thomas Anderson is with making a movie as specific as Phantom Thread. It's so defined, it's so perfect. It's about every stitch, and this is such great chaos. And the fact that he can do both those things is just incredible.
Go ahead.
I was gonna say like name is he does the best director working today? But like you have Tarantino, but he puts that movie so rarely.
It's hard. Fincher's gone. He doesn't count anymore. Right,
oh, he's
now.
Dead. He's dead in a fucking ditch.
My favorite director, active director, but he's not even active. So yeah, I remember after seeing back to back years, it was what, Rushmore, then Magnolia, Boogie Nights in between, and sort of the argument was like, who's the better Anderson? Like, which Andersons have a better career? Who's going to be more interesting? And like, Wes Anderson is fine, but he makes the same movie in different ways over and over and over again. I mean, look at, you know, this guy directed The Phantom Thread and Licorice Pizza. I mean, this guy directed Boogie Nights in this movie. So, like, yeah, I mean, I would say his next five movies, you know, yeah, I don't think I'd trade any other director for his next five movies, for sure.
And there's also Paul Wes Anderson, too, who Jeff and...
That's true.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
The creator of Underworld, among Paul many w. other Anderson. Jovovich movies.
Directed the worst movie I've seen this year.
Oh, in the Lost Lands.
In the Lost Lands. It's the worst movie.
One of our... Yeah, it is. It's that is also my worst year. That's... If you listen to mine and Ken Jack and Gooch for a while's old podcast, Lights, Camera, Barstool, he was one of, not Paul Thomas Anderson, the other, Paul W.S. Anderson was one of our two favorite directors, along with the flop comedic director, Michael Titties, who was also.
Yeah, Michael Titties. Favorites. Yeah, correct.
A legend of the game. Final kind of thought here before we move on to another movie, which I think we're going to have significantly different takes on, though probably all the same take, is where we kind of have it ranked. Everyone kind of gave their ranking already. For me, I have it behind Boogie Nights and I have it behind There Will Be Blood. But it is one of those things where it's like, it's kind of like irrelevant at that point. Like I wouldn't, you could all give me your ranking. And like, I understand, like I'm not as high on Phantom Thread as others. Like Clem might not be as high on The Masters as others, but like in the end, I don't think there's like a real, like, is there one, should there be one considered like, oh no, that should be his best. Like that should be his number. I don't think there is.
I mean, There Will Be Blood is just so towering, though. It's just so, I mean, Daniel Day-Lewis just is so huge in that.
It feels like the one that 50 years from now, like, will just last and hold up better than anything else he's made. It feels timeless.
We'll talk about that actor in a minute.
Yeah. Yeah. But Boogie Nights is great, too. I mean, yeah, I would put it, if you want to put it third or fourth, I'm fine with that.
I did a rewatch a year ago. It holds up so well. It's so well-paced. It's so well done. Like,
is that a timing thing, though, too? Like, if Boogie Nights had come out and still been as well received 2 years after There Will Be Blood, would Boogie Nights be that movie? Or is it because of that performance and how massive Daniel Day-Lewis is that it does sort of just stand like a little above?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, Boogie Nights is a young director's movie for sure.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, maybe. Yeah. But I mean, it's like, you know, But I think after that, it's kind of hard to put anything else he has inside that top four. There's some good ones, but I mean, I wouldn't.
You can find, like I said, expanded thoughts on our letterbox. They are below if you're watching on YouTube, or if you're listening, they're in the description below. One battle after another, 95 for me, 92 from Kirk, 93 from Ken Jack, 92 from Clemmer. Gooch gave it 5-star. Gooch kind of start putting numbers on things, but he gave it 100. He gave it 100.
4.8 from the audience, by the way, Jeff.
4.8. Yeah, that's... Again, this is one of those where I wasn't sure how the audience would feel. And then you see that this at an 85% from the audience, like at people, I didn't know. I walked out. I'm like, okay, I can see some people maybe not loving it because like maybe subject matter, you know. It is interesting too. We didn't talk too much on it, but I thought it was going to be significantly more heavy-handed and political after the first 20 minutes. They kind of just get you set up. And then once they make that flash forward, it is like, it's a little different. Anyway, excellent movie. Like, lived up to the hype. I don't know. Actually, one more thing. Did anyone like think it'd be this good when they saw the first trailer? Because I didn't. I mean, it's PTA, but I was like, oh, like I don't love what I first saw from this.
It's weird because like anytime one of our directors that we like gets like wades into anything that you could even perceive as like remotely political, like you kind of get worried. Like directors we've loved, like Adam McKay, we like a ton, and then he wades into the water and he just loses it. Sorkin loses it. Like certain directors and writers we like that sometimes they just don't know how to do it. And PTA, I just feel like I was definitely a little hesitant for sure. I would agree with you.
I mean, it's stupid. I stupidly kind of got caught up in this trailer stuff and like it's PTA. Like, I don't know why I worried about that, you know, but I did. I never connected to a trailer and I was totally wrong.
Which is funny. It's not like it misrepresented the movie at all. If you go back and watch that first trailer, it is exactly what the movie is. It almost gives away the entire movie.
Which I think that was my concern. Like, can it be goofy and also like intense? Like, I mean, it can.
It's hard to make a trailer for a movie like this because the movies are so unique. This is such a unusual movie. It's hard to market it, I imagine.
Yeah, that's character.
Hopefully it catches on more and more too. And more people see it. So it does build up to a pretty good showdown, which seems like for now, at least Sinners, maybe one or two other movies, at the Oscars. But if this is PTA's like coronation at the Academy Awards, this would be a pretty awesome one for him to win with.
Look, if you're a bigger guy like us, have you ever bought a shirt that technically fits, but it doesn't like actually fit? That's why this is my favorite brand of all f***ing time. One Bone. I'm in love with everything that I put on today. In fact, I would say I've never loved a brand more than One Bone. Trust me, you guys are going to romanticize getting dressed in the morning. That's what One Bone does. Go to onebone.com and upgrade to a fit that is actually built for you. Use code Barstool for 20% off to see the difference firsthand. After one wear, you'll understand why standard fits don't make the cut.
Smashing Machine, next up on the list here. You want to talk about a change in tone. I'm going to read the synopsis last because the synopsis is the most perfect synopsis for this movie I've ever seen. Runtime, 2 hours and 3 minutes. Directed by Benny Safdie. The Safdie brothers split up. One is making this movie. The other is, they didn't split up, but they split up. Well, they split to make these two movies. They didn't like, it's not like Oasis. They don't like hate each other. But the other Safdie making the ping pong movie, Marty Supreme with Timothy Chalamet and Benny Safdie. And
Kevin O'Leary.
Yep, Shark Tank's own Kevin O'Leary, Mr. Wonderful. Benny Safdie, who was in, by the way, he was in Oppenheimer, so forever a legend, but also in this year's Happy Gilmore 2.
Also a legend, yeah.
Which I'm sure he wishes he wasn't. Based on the 2002 HBO documentary, also titled The Smashing Machine, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, Emily Blunt, Ryan Bader made $2.7 million at the box office this weekend. Holy shit. Lowest all time, I believe, for The Rock in a debut. 73% of Rotten Tomatoes by the critics, 78% by the audience. IMDb 7.1, Metacritic 65, Letterboxd 3.4. Here is the synopsis. Story of legendary mixed martial arts UFC fighter Mark Kerr. That's it. That's all. Like that's perfect because that's what this movie is to me. I'm gonna start.
Where's the lie?
Like it's a what is the what why who like this was. I walk out of this movie like, what? What did I just, like, what was the point? Like, what was that? I gave it a 65. It's not a horrendous movie by any means. It's just kind of nothing. It's got some good performances. It looks great. Like, he knows how to direct a movie. But I've also seen the documentary. I don't know who else here has seen the documentary. I don't. And I respect that Benny Safdie, the creative liberties thing. I respect that you don't want to do a cliche sports movie, but sometimes you got to take a couple creative liberties because this was boring and repetitive. I mean, it was like if I would have been like drunk, I think I would have been like, are they repeating the same scene over and over again at this point? Like, what is this the same fucking thing? We'll talk. The big thing to talk about is The Rock. We'll get to that in a second. But I gave it a 65. Ken Jack, what'd you give it?
I ended up on a 70. I think like when you make a movie like this, there's like a very specific balance that you need to hit for a biopic when like you look at the entertainment value of a movie. And I think in this case, they're loyal to Mark Kerr's story to a fault, which like you were saying, you need to make a few creative liberties for the sake of like the entertainment value. I think otherwise you're just kind of making a dramatized documentary. And, you know, I get that like it's a real story, but like these ebbs and flows just aren't satisfying. Like the real story is not like that is not satisfying on an entertainment level. So the story part I don't love, but the parts of it versus the whole I do. Like I found The Rock's performance pretty like interesting and against type for him usually. And I like the production value across two different continents, like in Japan in the early 2000s and the US in the early 2000s. It looked great visually. It was not structurally made to be entertaining or it's tough to watch.
I won't spoil how it ends. But if you've seen the documentary, the end of that documentary and the movie are like a shot for shot same thing, which I think is crazy to do. I'm shocked that he did that. Kirk, what'd you give it?
I gave it 62, and that feels generous. It's one of the most boring movies of all. It just is over and over and over and over, and I don't understand the point of it. Like, I get this guy has probably led an interesting life. I didn't see it. You know, it was – you know, he would be kind of quiet and Emily Blunt would show up and be a bitch and then he'd be kind of an asshole and then they'd break apart and the other guy would be like, oh, it's okay. The truth is, you know, if you had to make a movie, the other guy who's living with his wife, he's got his kids, he's at beck and call for Mark Kerr. He's been down, he's older and comes back. And I don't like your spoilers away, but there's a big part with him at the end. That's a traditional sports movie. Like, I understand he didn't want to make a traditional sports movie, but you know, I keep reading interviews with him or listening to podcasts where he references like Rocky III is an influence on this movie. And I don't, you know, Rocky III is one of my favorite movies. I'm not saying it's a great film, but like none of that is there. None of it. The Rock is pretty good. We'll get to that. But as a story, I was sitting there thinking, this is like the ninth time I've watched this same scene happen in this movie. Like, what is going to, and for something not to happen at the end of this movie that you're waiting for the whole time is crazy. I don't even, like, I get that it didn't happen. I respect that. But then don't make the movie. Like, you can also
want to see him checking out at the grocery store?
Yeah.
The little guy?
Yeah. But I'm waiting for these two guys. And at the end, like, he's just in the shower. And I'm like, what the fuck is going on here? Like, what? I want to see these guys. And I don't understand why it was made. So The Rock brought it to Safdie. And like, I get why The Rock wanted to make it. The guy's, you know, I guess kind of a complicated guy, but boy, this was a huge miss. And if Marty Supreme is great, I think we might have our answer here as to who the talent is in the family, because this was not good.
Yeah, this was a bummer. Gooch, what'd you give it?
Yeah, let me kind of launch off that. You'll hear our conversation with Benny at the end of this episode, and you can kind of hear his thought process in there, where I think he saw that documentary and I think he wished he had made that documentary, but it already existed. And so he set out on this weird experimental filmmaking journey of trying to shoot a sports film in a documentarian style. And I think he does really succeed. Like, there's some really cool filmmaking stuff where it really immerses you from the 90s up to the 2000s in the way that they use different film stock, shooting on digital. It's very immersive. And I actually quite enjoyed that part of it. But the story, like you guys said, it just lacks too much. There's no narrative punch to it at all. And it's the drama that it is there is just stuff that we've seen so many times before. So there's really nothing to latch onto here outside of The Rock's performance, because it is the biggest movie star in the world. He is good, but just not enough there for me to want to ever sit through this again.
Well, he's not the biggest movie star in the world anymore, Gooch. That's
I guess. I guess not.
Long,
yeah.
Long. Black Adam. That is
2.7 mil doesn't do it for you.
Black Adam. Like, we are. The Rock is. Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, yeah. But that was.
Which might be the biggest takeaway from this movie. But yeah, I'm at a 65 out of 100. And I'm kind of on the same page as Kirk. It feels generous at this point, but I do think this is
well made, if nothing else. Like, it's not.
Yeah, really, I think Gooch is right. It's really well made. Like, it's directed well. Like, it's just a boring. It's a well directed. It's as good as you can do with that story. Like, you're right. Like, the beginning, the first shots, the way it looked. Like Ken Jack said, Japan. Like, looks great. Like, he's a talented director, but like, it is. There is not. I don't even know what the story is.
Right. Clemmer, and I'll let you, Clemmer, kind of dive into the next thing, which is The Rock stuff. And I think the big quest with The Rock stuff, for me at least, is I think we're going to agree, good performance, but are we hyping it too much just because, like, oh, holy shit, The Rock was an ass. He was actually pretty good. Are we, like, giving him too much credit just because we're stunned The Rock had a good, like, dramatic performance? And, of course, what did you give the movie as well?
Yeah, so I give this a 71. Everything you guys said was right. It's weird. It's like you have all these great ingredients to make a meal and it comes out just incredibly bland. Like, I don't really know. And it's funny, if you look at the things, it's like, oh, substance abuse, relationship issues, fighting, like this, that's Safdie brother. Like, this should be, it's well made, it's well shot, it should work. And it just doesn't, like, for everything you guys said. As far as with The Rock's performance, he's really good in it, but there's such little that happens, and Kirk talks about how at the end he's in this shower, and you're like, all right, well, maybe, you know, maybe this movie's about the quest for peace, and that's what this is about. But then the title cards at the end, that might not even be the case. I don't even know what this movie's about.
Yeah.
And when you have kind of a unstable or instable, like, why this movie exists, it makes the performance lesser, because it's like, all right, then what were we watching? What was he striving to do? And I don't know. So yes, he was fantastic, but Jeff, you might be right. Like, maybe we are just over, just because it's so unusual for him to do that. And at the end of the day, I can see this movie being forgotten between the box office being so bad and the movie really not connecting with anybody. The cinema score was B-. Like, this doesn't, I can see this being just in the waste bin of history by December or January.
The thing with him in this movie is I do think he was really good, but I also don't think even if he was better, like, I don't think it allowed him to kind of expand, because you're just kind of seeing, it's almost like they, it's almost like he said, it's almost like he released a reel, an acting reel, and just gave us like five of the same thing. It's like, oh, let me give it another go. There was a fork in the road moment for the movie for me, where I think if there had been different decisions made, I actually think it could have been great. And it was when he ripped the fucking door off. When he ripped the door off in the room.
Yeah, you're kind of waiting for that. You're waiting for that.
Right.
He's got this quiet menace the whole time. It's very good. He builds sort of this right. Yeah.
And he's sitting on the chair in the kitchen. She comes over, and then it kind of cuts quickly to his friend, and she's screaming on the phone that he OD'd, or he had, like, you know, something happened to him with the drugs he did. And it was kind of this weird. I was like, wait, what? Like, did I miss something? They skipped to this? Like, there was this moment where you feel like they didn't hit this lane that would have been the right path to take. And then from there, it was kind of like the same choppy thing of being repetitive. And I don't think it never capitalized on that part that I thought was probably the lead up to it being a better movie. And it never did.
No, I think that there's something that I feel they're on the right path with was Emily Blunt's character. Like, the boxer's wife, the fighter's wife character, such a stereotype, and, like, they're always doing the same thing. In this movie, they gave her some depth. Like, she's an asshole. And that's never the case in these movies. They're always the same angelic figure versus the fighter. And I think they'd had something cool there, and they just never really got that to fruition, I think. And there could have been something, but not there. But, yeah, I think I would agree with you. There was definitely that little, like, they give you, like, it's almost like they tease you. You know, like, here, we're almost giving you, like, a climax. We're almost giving you, like, an ebb and of you know, thematic flow, but, like, you don't get it. You just kind of get what's, again, stuck to the story, which just isn't that entertaining.
See, I mean, you're right, Ken Jack, that it's different, but in some ways it's almost the same, because she's then just totally like that. Like, you know, the other ones are totally angelic, but in this one, I need, like, a scene where Emily Blunt is, like, a human being. I mean, they make her out. Like, she's a fucking I'm not talking about, you know, I mean, I know the scene with Jungle Land playing with her, but I'm saying, like, I need a scene where she's, like, a normal, kind of quiet, like, she just seems like a horrible human being the whole time.
Why is he with her? Yeah. Like, we never know. Like, what? Why is she? Why are they in this relationship at all? Why is she going back to her?
And she's
this
a movie.
Yeah, go ahead. No,
this
go.
Movie. This movie needed something, and Emily Blunt and all these low cut tops was, I think, all they had.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah, no complaint. But, like, if you look at her last, like, Oppenheimer, obviously a great movie, but she's playing, like, the woman behind the man. In The Fall Guy, she's kind of playing, like, a second. Like, in this movie, like, This is a really good actress. Like, I'd like to see her, you know, kind of do something else here. This is, I feel like, beneath her. It felt like a waste of her talent.
You said this earlier, and I think a lot of people have echoed this who've seen it, is the Ryan Bader character is the character that almost sticks out as a better story. And I think that it's insane that comes to that, but I think there's a easy way to explain that is – you have a lot of moments in the movie where you want to root against her because she's kind of being an asshole. But every moment I was like, man, fuck the Emily Blunt character. He'd be like, hey, you're not doing the cactus, like, maintenance, right?
Right,
like,
yeah, the stuff in the pool.
This guy's a dick too. And yeah, I'm right, like, yeah. I kind of hate them both. And so I'm like, well, who the fuck do I root for here? And I got this guy in the background who is.
Yeah. I thought this was supposed to be skim milk or whatever. Yeah.
Like, all right.
No, you're right. No, but, like, that's why. How about you guys? But, like, I was rooting for the other character. Like, oh, I wanted him to win. And maybe that was Safdie's point to his credit. Maybe I'm just reading it wrong, but I don't think that's the road to success, is to have your lead character, big movie star, rooting against him. I don't think that was the intention, but yeah.
That's where the creative liberties is, like, and Kendrick, you reference Aaron Sorkin. Aaron Sorkin famously talks about creative liberties and, like, changing things up. And, like, you know, this is not a history book. You know, you're telling a story, it's art that has history involved with it. You can tell the main part of that story. You can tell the concept of what you're trying to get across without needing to be beat for beat what happens. Like, why not have him fight at the end? Have him lose.
Or just do a different fucking movie. Just be like, you know what? Like, Gucci, it's like the documentary is excellent. Like, whenever these guys try and make these documentaries into real movies, they almost always suck. What was the I liked it. The one, I didn't like the movie with the guy walking across the
Man on Wire.
It's just like, you know. The documentaries are really good for a reason. Like, generally, it doesn't work as well.
Hey, you know this really gripping documentary of real footage of a guy walking in between the Twin Towers? Here's a fake version with Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Oh, yeah, we all hate him. But, yeah, it was brutal, brutal.
So Smashing Machine, it is weird because it's one of those ones where you're not going to give it a bottom-of-the-barrel score because it's a well-made movie. There's some good stuff in it. There's some good performances. The Rock will be right up there. I would assume for an Oscar, I think even if you don't consider it to be one of the best of the year, it's one of those things where it's like, obviously, you got to assume he's going to get nominated, like the hype behind it. And that, you know, we got the 15 minute standing ovation this summer at one of the festivals. Yeah, like it's. Yeah.
Whatever that means.
Dude, right? We got to have a conversation about the fucking Venice Film Festival.
It's fake.
We got to have a fucking conversation. This movie cleaning up there. What the fuck? You're the
best director there, right?
Did After the Hunt clean up somewhere too?
Probably.
Because that's another one I watched. We're not talking about After the Hunt today. I watched After the Hunt. I was like, what the fuck is this?
The Rock, the reports were that The Rock was crying so hard that he lost bodily control, they said, at the 50. Literally, this is like reports. Like, and I think Safdie won best director there, right? I think he won the Venice. So, I mean, yeah, I don't. Yeah, right. 15. Imagine like watching that movie, like 9 minutes in, being like, all right, we got 6 more minutes of the standing ovation. This is how much this movie meant to me. Like, I don't even understand it.
Yeah.
One more thing. Like, I see it's in, like, if you're The Rock, so, you know, you kind of built, this has been a big deal for you. You've been like pubbing this movie like crazy. What is he? Does he just go back now? Is it like Stallone after Copland? Does he say, well, fuck it. Like, yeah. Back to action? Or
crazy movie, isn't he?
Well, that's true. Yeah, he is supposedly. I mean, I don't know.
And
but like
he's also doing another movie with Benny, I believe.
Yeah, we'll see if that
which
happens.
I don't know. It's weird. He obviously hit a point in his career these past few years where, you know, general audiences, I think, were starting to see through the Rockness of it all, the marketing arm of The Rock. And I think he's trying to gain trust with like the general movie going audience. And you know, whether or not his like efforts here are like genuine, like he really wants to be a great actor or not, I don't know. But he did put in the work. Like he really did put in the work, and he tried to do this.
Yeah, credit there for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But will he continue with it? This is a really bad bomb. Like this
he's
is
the best part of this movie, though. I don't think it's his.
No.
No.
I also don't think this is a movie you necessarily measure by box office just because it's such a niche subject. Like, yeah, it's The Rock, but like how many people are huge fans of Mark Kerr or even MMA that are going to like line up and go see this in the theater? So like,
it is kind of classic Rock too, though, where it's like, you know, I know we did this a couple years ago with Adam Sandler, but like Adam Sandler had other dramatic movies before Uncut Gems. Speaking of the Safdies, like he had PTA, Punch Drunk. Like he's had other things. I love that The Rock does like his first dramatic one, and you know, the marketing machine on Team The Rock was like, this is it. This is the one. It's like, maybe do this one. And then the next one's the one that you put your entire weight behind to win best actor. I don't know.
I think box office matters too, Kenjack. I disagree with that. It's cost $50 million to make. Like, and this was promoted to death. You're not going to give the Safdies another check for $50 million again after this.
I think for them, yes, for The Rock, that I don't think that necessarily. He just wants to be recognized as an actor. I think his objective is different than Benny Safdie's in this case. Like, he wants to be like, hey, I can act. And in this case, I think it works because every role he's taken for 20 plus years has been they create the role around The Rock persona. And this is the first role where he has changed The Rock persona to fit the role. And I think that that is like a sign like, hey, he can act. And now he can go and do other things, hopefully for him, or The Rock anyway.
He could always do like Jumanji 3 if he needs to.
I think he literally just said that today that the filming begins soon for that.
Definitely. Like, that should not make, yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah. I think he's doing that. So like, and then he can
do Pain and Gain too.
Pain and Gain. I'd watch the second one. Tony Chalut, get him back.
Very quickly before we move on from the reviews here. So obviously big recommendation. I mean, first off, as always, see every movie in theaters you possibly can. But if we're going to pick one or the other, one battle after the other, that's not even fucking close out of those two movies. Justin, your score for each and then a max 3-word review for each movie.
For One Battle, I gave it a 48. And it's DNC Antifa Propaganda.
Okay. All right. Okay.
Smashing, I give a 60. And worst blunt rock movie.
That's 4 words.
That's 4 words. So that's already a
an acronym count against the word count.
Oh, so okay. So that was we just worked in our first indirect reference to Jungle Cruise on this podcast by.
Oh, that's true.
What's going on there? Why are they in so many movies together?
Yeah, that is strange.
What the fuck is that?
Yo, Arnold.
Yeah, I don't really understand the. Yeah, I mean, I assume. It seems like it's a Rock project all the way from, you guys interviewed Safdie, but that's, you know, some maybe. I mean, I guess they worked together in Oppenheimer, though, too, Safdie and Emily Blunt. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hey, it's Fran from Chicks in the Office. It's peak summer. One plan is turning into 5, but trust, I'll be wearing Abercrombie to all of them. Catch me in their Sloan tailored pan at work and then the happy hour right after. The Dylan dress for dinner plans when you want something easy but still put together. And of course, their denim. Because Abercrombie denim just works, no matter the plan. Keep up with the pace of summer without overthinking it. Shop in the app, online, and in stores.
All right, this part of the podcast will be known as Cinema. We will just be running down some movies. We won't go too long on these reviews, but just some quick hits, quick thoughts. So things that are in theaters or on stream, you know what we think. I'll let you know if it's worth not just going to theaters, but definitely worth picking up that remote and turning on streaming, because some of them are not worth it, and I think the first one may fall under that. Play Dirty from Shane Black, starring Mark Wahlberg, the creator of the streetwear brand Municipal.
Municipal? Yeah. Municipal. Let's give it the respect, yeah.
Also, that prayer app.
That's right.
Yeah, forgot about that.
Mickey Stanfield, Nat Wolf, brother of the other Wolf, who actually yelled at me and Ken Jack for not liking the Jumanji trailer a couple years ago. Speaking of Jumanji, Keegan-Michael Key. It's on Amazon Prime Video. Again, Shane Black, 2 hours and 5 minutes. Expert Thief Parker. It's based on the book series Parker by Donald E. Westlake. Expert Thief Parker gets a shot at a major heist, but to pull it off, he and his team must outsmart a South American dictator, the New York mob, and the world's richest man. It's 47% on Rotten Tomatoes, 6.0 on IMDb, Metacritic 46, Letterboxd 2.7. I gave it a 41 out of 100. I think this movie stunk. And I actually was stunned when I saw people say, like, return to form for Shane Black. First of all, talking about Shane Black like he's fucking Martin Scorsese. Wouldn't return to fight. He's had a couple really good ones, and he's had a couple like stinkers. It's not like he has this crazy catalog. So yeah, 41 out of 100 for me. Clemmer, I think you watched it today. What do you think of Play Dirty?
Yeah, this is terrible. I give it 29. The only pushback I'll say, though, is like, so this movie's way too long. I mean, every minute feels like 10. It's just atrocious. Mark Wahlberg, you can see the dollar signs in their eyes. Like, Tony Shalhoub, these guys are just completely checked out.
You can barely see his eyes. I thought Wahlberg was going to fall asleep at some point. That's unbelievable.
They're barely there. It's conscious. And it's, you wonder, like, with these movies, I don't know if they're on, like, the stream movies are just there, like, so you play with your phone while you're watching. Like, I don't watch movies that way. I'm like, when I watch movies, I shut the lights off, I get super focused, and I watch a movie. Like, this movie is, I think, meant to be just a watch of the corner of your eye. And Shane Black, though, The Nice Guys, is a really good movie. He wrote Lethal Weapon. Like, this is a guy that has a pretty great resume, albeit a smaller one, but has some really good movies in there. And Mark Wahlberg was in Flight Risk, and I know that movie wasn't very good, but he was pretty fucking good in it, and it was fun to watch. This is just a mess. This was awful. When, Jeff, when you told me I had to watch that last night, I watched it. I got through like an hour and 10. I'm like, I gotta go to bed. I watched the rest of it this morning. It ruined my morning. This movie sucks.
What? Clever. When you think of Mark Wahlberg's career and you come to the defense of it.
No, I usually think of Three Kings, maybe, or Boogie Nights. I don't know.
No, my point is that it was just this year a decent performance. Okay. Like, it's not like this guy is like completely like.
Clemmer, it wasn't like on the waterfront. I mean, it was Flight Risk. I mean,
I know, but he was exciting and interesting in it. The movie sucked. He was by far the best thing in it. So he still has those chops. He made that, 6 months earlier? Like, he's still there. Like, this was just
He didn't care about that one, too. He did not give a fuck about
this.
He is giving.
Dreadful.
Oh my god.
He is giving.
Would you give it, Clemmer?
29.
Ken Jack, you. I'll let you talk about maybe the worst opening scene in the most preposterous opening scene in the movie I've ever seen.
So fucking stupid. The dumbest, like most like half-assed heist into like getting shot off a mountain into water, all CGI throughout the entire thing. So stupid. Like. I gave it a 30 out of 100. And I think that, like, that middle run, like you guys are mentioning, Shane Black, like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Nice Guys, like movies great. That really emphasize, like, chemistry and, like, character to, like, having it and just – it's the opposite of that. This and, like, The Predator, total opposite of that. No chemistry between anybody in this cast at all. And it just has this, like, character-devoid sheen that all these streaming movies have to it where it's, like, they do not give a shit about them. And I really hate it. And it's kind of like – the Mark Wahlberg does a lot of movies like this. Like, was it Infinity – or whatever, or like we'll have a random streaming movie that just gets thrown out there, and you're like, this actually was real, and people got paid millions and millions and millions of dollars to make it, and I couldn't believe it, man. Absolute fucking garbage, and I think Wahlberg needs to abandon these tough guy roles, because he's charming when he wants to be. He's crazy like he wants to be, like in Oscar-contending movies like Flight Risk, but he's also, like, when he wants to be, like, cool, like a dad in Instant Family, he's charming, he's great in that, but these tough guy roles gotta go. It's just, that part of his life is over to me.
Kirk?
Yeah, I mean, same thing. I'm looking at Wahlberg here since, you know, he had the hit with Tom Holland. Okay. And you're thinking, okay, he's kind of back. Since then, Father Stu, Me Time, The Family Plan, Arthur the King, The Union, Flight Risk, and Play Dirty. That's what we've got from Mark Wahlberg. And Ken Jack's right. I've always felt Wahlberg playing a tough guy is weird. Like Dirk Diggler was like sensitive and kind of high-pitched and weak. And that's kind of like how I like my Wahlberg served. I've always liked him that way. Even Three Kings, like he's, you know, kind of macho, but then he's very soft. Even The Fighter, he can be like that. So now he's still, like, he thinks, I don't know if he thinks he has to be like Clint Eastwood or something at this point in his career, but you can see he literally, like, doesn't care at all. Like, this is a lifeless performance. Like, just 0.0 there. I don't know why he keeps doing these strikes. I mean, I know why. But, I mean, he's got a, you know, at some point in his career, you know, even like The Departed, like these guys match up with directors. Like Leo matched up with Scorsese, for example, or De Niro did the same thing. At some point, Wahlberg was like, Peter Berg's going to be my guy. and he spent like 8 years working with Peter Berg, who, you know, was a decent action director. But, and we just lost him. Like he's gone. Like I don't know if we can get him back. And now he's, you know, he's the app with the ashes on his head. And like, I don't know what the fuck is going on with this guy. He's nuts.
I thought he didn't want to do violent movies anymore.
Like he was going to do like different types of stuff.
And then I'm not going to spoil this movie, God forbid, but there's
go ahead. Come on.
I mean, at the end of the movie, he shoots someone and the door is closed. We never see the killing. And I wonder if that's like his choice because he doesn't want to, you know, shoot someone.
Well, Flight Risk is pretty violent.
Yeah, but like, yes. I will say, I don't know if he kills anyone at Flight Risk, though.
No, but he's like beating up, isn't he like beating up a woman in that movie at times?
Yeah, beating up a woman.
Doesn't seem to want to kill women anymore, though, on screen. I don't know. It was just weird that was shot with the door closed. Like, so we, like, I don't know. It's just terrible. It sucked.
That fucking, what'd you give it, Kirk? Sorry.
22?
That opening scene on the fucking racetrack is like a high school kid. It's incredible. Ocean's 11. He's like, let's make a sick heist movie and has no idea what he's doing. Like, it was terrible.
I didn't know that this was a based on a book series because he also did that movie Spencer Confidential, which was also like kind of a similar type deal, right? And that bombed and that was terrible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yuck.
Terrible.
Gooch.
Yeah, I'm at a 20 out of 100. Mark Wahlberg, a fucking idiot. and I think the best directors know when to play to their actors' strengths. And Mark Wahlberg's a fucking idiot. That's why every time he plays an idiot on screen, those are his best performances. Boogie Nights, The Other Guys, The Departed. When he's a dumbass, it works. When he tries to be the superhero guy, he's not that. He just isn't. Also, one more thing. We've kind of covered this all. Did streaming movies always look this bad? They're getting worse, shit. Right? They're looking worse and worse.
It's terrible. Bad.
That's what's shocking about Shane Black. You have a legit director who's even the movies of Shane Black's like I don't love. Like they look like this looks horrific.
Shocking. It was even worse. Literally, while that opening scene at the racetrack is happening, my mom is sending me pictures from Keeneland Racetrack of like real horses watching the Breeders' Cup, and I'm looking at these monstrosities on screen. And then it's somehow not even the worst. I think the train sequence in the middle part of the movie is somehow even worse when Lakeith Stanfield jumps out and just rolls across the pavement like a CGI, like NPC figure in a video game. It's, ugh, gross.
Yeah, bad movie. Play Dirty. If you want to stream, it's on Amazon Prime. But I would suggest I'd stream other things first, for sure. Here's a movie that not all of us saw. We'll run through this one quick. Anatomy with Daniel Day-Lewis, directed by Ronan Day-Lewis.
So oh, wow, huh?
Back. Interesting. comes back doing a favor for his kid. Sean Bean in it, the legend himself. Also in it, 2 hours and 6 minutes. It's very limited release right now. A couple of us saw it over the weekend. This made $310,000 at the box office. Again, it's not in many theaters. Poor on tomato scores in the 50s and 60s. Letterboxd 2.9. Kirk, you can start. This was... holy shit.
The greatest actor ever lived in a, like, I mean, I don't know how many monologues he gave in this movie, but 400 of them in this movie. Sean Bean just sits there and nods the whole time. It's just an endless fucking movie. I'm dying to see Daniel Day-Lewis in the movie. Dying to see him in the movie. Said he retired. He comes back. You're like, all right, This must be something. Trailer, like, okay, not bad. All right, maybe there's something here. I'm sitting, it's kind of in a way sort of a cousin, the Smash Machine. I'm like, is there, like, what am I, is something going to happen here? Like, what? So, okay, it's another scene where you talk, him and Sean Bean are talking, and then Sean Bean nods, and Day-Lewis goes in this monologue. And Day-Lewis is great. He's great. He's a great actor in a horrible, horrible movie. The movie itself kind of looks like a music video anyway. It's like shot late.
Yeah.
It's just another fucking horrible movie.
The tone and
movie.
Like the type of movie it's trying to be, I can't figure out.
Yes, totally.
Like, Day-Lewis watched Phantom Thread was like, I can try that. Like, let me give that a spin. And it didn't work. Speaking of Tony Gwynn, I was going to do Michael Jordan Wizards, but the top comment on Letterboxd says, this is like Tony Gwynn coming back from retirement and playing for the team that plays the Savannah Bananas. Like, this is that's
right. He comes out and gets a standing ovation.
Bottom of the 40 out of a, or what'd you give it? Sorry.
Oh, geez. I have 42.
Yeah, I gave it a 40. Ken, Jack, you were the other one who got to see it. This was a fucking bore fest.
Yeah, I give it like a 40, and I do like 20 points for Daniel Day-Lewis, who I think is great. Like, he maxes out everything he can for get sure. out of the role, but and then 20 points for some of the audiovisual stuff's really cool. Like, he gets some really cool shots of countryside, some interesting music and stuff. But other than that, like, there's just nothing there.
I thought of three movies since Day-Lewis retired, three that he would have been great in. For sure, roles he would have been great in. He would have been great in Penn's role.
Yeah.
In one, but he would have been great.
Yeah, wow.
Would have been great in De Niro's role in Kills of Flower Moon. Mm-hmm. And he would have been great as Frank Drebin in The Naked Gun.
Yeah.
You would have been great. You would have been great.
Could you imagine?
A great against type, serious guy. Probably not as good as Neeson, but he would have been great in that movie. And instead, I'm watching this where he's just sitting there brooding and the fire and then he's just like, oh. And this, I mean, it's nice he's doing this movie with his son, but oh, it was hard. I mean,
it was like a tome, dude. It went so long. Like, every time I look up and I'm like, there's no way it's still going on. Like, there's nothing happening.
Spent the last 8 years building fiddles and chairs to make this, and he just comes out of retirement, makes this movie.
I also don't appreciate him trying to gaslight us into believing that he didn't retire.
No, it was very
clear. He's like, I never very retired.
Clear.
What?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Clover,
that's
sorry.
Bullshit.
Yeah, is there any chance that he gets a nomination for this just because of the name? No, right?
No.
Nah, this movie's a gonzo. Okay. Like, gone. Yeah, I don't think so. But I hope he works again the next 8 years. He's 68 now.
I saw and heard some reviews, and this is a good transition to the next thing we're going to talk about, Megadoc, where people were like, Ronan Day-Lewis, you can tell he's got the crowd. I'm like, fuck off. You don't got to say it's good because Daniel Day-Lewis. Like, let's not do that. Come on. Megadoc. A movie which you want to talk about reviews that have not – movies reviewing is subjective. I think have not aged very well. There's some funny reviews on Megalopolis that are up there that you're like, there's no way they still think this. Megadoc is the documentary following the production of Megalopolis by Francis Ford Coppola. This thing was fantastic, Gooch. This was – what a peek behind the curtain on one of – I actually would say one of the five most absurd – movies pound for pound. Like, I'm not counting like one of those ripoff, like scary movie type movies, like pound for pound by like a real director with real actors. One of the top of the most absurd things I've ever seen in my life, which got worse every time I thought about it. Megalopolis. But this is a very cool documentary if you can go find it.
Yeah, I will slap the must watch label on this. If you're an A-lister, if you're seeing, you know, multiple movies a month and you like going to the movies, you like movies, you will love this. Even if you didn't like Megalopolis, you hated it. Or even if you loved it, because it is, like Jeff said,
honestly, it
is such an absurd, the level of access that Coppola gave to Mike Figgis to make this thing is just insane. I've really never seen anything like it. All the actors, for the most part, except for one, are very open and candid, especially Shia LaBeouf, who just, it's an Oscar-worthy performance by itself. And then Aubrey Plaza is just fantastic. It is very good. I'm usually not a documentary person, but this is so great.
Go ahead, Kirk.
Oh, yeah, I saw it. It might be my favorite movie of the year. There's nothing I like better than a mess. You know, Devil's Candy is a great book. The Making of the Bonfire of the Vanities, very similar to that. Julie Solomon got full access from De Palma behind the scenes of Bonfire of the Vanities and wrote this great book. And this is the exact same thing. You're watching exactly. You watched Megalopolis a year ago, and you think, how could this possibly be this sloppy and bizarre and weird and just off. Then you watch the documentary, you think, oh, well, this is exactly why it happened. It's funny. I just watched Project Greenlight season 2, where you see Shia for the first time as like a young kid. He's being interviewed. He's all happy. He's excited. Oh, here comes Hollywood. I can't wait. And you compare it with this, where he is just in Coppola's face the whole time. And Coppola's doing the thing where he's like, hey, just do it. We'll do it this way or that. It's just art. If it's a mistake, it's great. And Shia's like, no, like, I want to sit here. Like, and they're just going back and forth. And yeah, you have a lot of Aubrey Plaza. And my guy, 2 years in a row, he's in Reagan, one of my favorite movies of last year. And he's in Megadoc. My guy, John Voight, comes in and brings it. And Dustin Hoffman out of left field for the last
half. The old guys were great.
Oh, Hoffman, Voight. It's a reunion. It's a fucking reunion. And they're both like, you know, like what are we doing here? You can't capture the madness of it unless you see it. It's crazy. It's probably like a 96 for me or something. I love stuff like it. I wish it was 30 hours. It was so great.
Thoughts for anyone else who's thought? If not, definitely check it out. This is, again, I think what Gooch said is perfect. Even if you don't like documentaries, like if you like movies, this is kind of like a must see. Because a messy behind the scenes must see. A good example, I've never seen The Phantom Menace behind the scenes. What a peek behind the curtain that is. This actually George Lucas, some good stuff.
Oh, MVP Lucas in this movie too. Oh, yeah. He's great.
The Lucas stuff was fascinating. Fascinating because it's him. He's almost taking shots at Coppola in a way. And the way he compares his commercialized career to, he's like almost defending, you know, the way he sold out, or I guess maybe it didn't sell out, but the way he built his enterprise on franchising and selling merch. And then he's like, Coppola doesn't have any fucking money. These are the seeds he sowed. Like, he's kind of dunking on them.
I've heard him say that quote a million times. He's like, you know, Coppola says, like, you know, Jacques Tati was bankrupt when he passed away financing his own last movie. And he almost says it as – but he keeps saying it during, like, the making of and, like, the pre-release. And I'm like, when he was saying it, did he, like, know this was going to be a fucking shit? Because he's making another movie now. This wasn't his last thing.
I don't know how that's going to happen. I don't know.
That's just crazy. One more movie. An unexpected movie review here before we talk about the trailer for J. Kelly. Clemmer saw the Taylor Swift movie, which is the album release movie. Clemmer, please give almost word for word what you told us about this movie.
Well, the issue with this movie is you get access, but it's so limited. So you this, like, obviously there's not going to be any honesty in a movie like this because it's an album release. I get all that. But you're seeing her make it behind the scenes videos, but not seeing the why. Like, why is she want? She's the biggest star in the world. Why don't we know why she wants the music video to look a certain way? That's so much more interesting. And there's a lot of these lyric videos, but behind the lyric video is just a 20-second clip over and over again, like almost like you're at a bad karaoke bar. So like, I really don't understand. You know, if it was more Taylor Swift, it would have been so much better. She directed it. Her credits is directed on it. So like, I don't know why this wasn't more of her insight. I give us a 46.
Keith sent a review to us in a group chat. It's made my favorite review of a movie I've ever read. He said, just saw a Taylor Swift movie and found it pretty toothless. I love that you walked out with like these people seeing it. They're like, oh, the album that you're like, that movie, what a fucking waste.
I didn't see it, but like compare it to like Madonna when she made Truth or Dare at her peak. Like, she wasn't afraid to look bad in that movie, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Not even to look bad. Like, you could even frame it where you look good, but you're at least making choices or explaining why. We never get that explanation of why. And that, I feel like, it's kind of a lost opportunity. I guess there is – I was talking with Keegs about it. I guess she said they are making a documentary, so maybe we'll get more of the why.
Oh, there. I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure it'll be really why.
Yeah, it's album promotion, and that's just kind of
– it doesn't need to be – negative. It just explained to us a choice.
She's figured out a system though for gaming that box office, that's for sure.
33 million this weekend, number one movie of the week.
Benny Safdie has to want to just he just drew the shortest stick with, I mean, One Battle After Another coming out the week before, having just insane word of mouth, so people are going to flood in. And then Taylor Swift 2 weeks before this movie comes out just being like, yeah, I'm gonna release my most anticipated album yet with a theatrical experience. It's gonna absolutely take all the screens and all the money. That sucks.
Trailer thoughts on this trailer, and then we'll move on. We'll do a couple quick hits here. Just go down the list of anyone some people have seen. But in terms of expanded thoughts, Jay Kelly, famous movie star Jay Kelly and his devoted manager Ron embark on an unexpectedly profound journey through Europe. Along the way, both men confront the choices they've made, relationships and loved ones, and the legacies they'll leave behind. Hits theaters November 14th for a very brief release window, and then Netflix December 5th from Noah Baumbach. George Clooney's in the movie, playing what seems to be George Clooney. Adam Sandler getting a lot of hype for his role. A lot of talk that he'll get nominated. Laura Dern, Billy Crudup, Riley Keough. There's a lot of random huge names in this movie. Kenjack, did the Jay Kelly... I don't know where I stand. I got to still think a little more about this, but where do you stand the Jay Kelly trailer? Did it do a lot for you? Because this movie has a lot of hype, like Oscar hype behind it.
It's weird because like I like everything involved, right? Like I like Clooney to a degree. I like Adam Sandler a lot, and I think he's proven he can do dramatic roles, like at least in his filmography so far. And I like Baumbach, so like I feel like he's good with scripts as far as like building interpersonal relationships. So like all the ingredients are here, but when I watch the trailer, I'm just kind of like not into it. I don't know how to explain it. It's just maybe the story isn't necessarily me, like not like hopping off the board. But I said we just talked about how we kind of had the same feeling with One Battle After Another. So maybe we're just being dumb here, but I don't know. I again love all the crew, so maybe that's something.
Yeah, it's kind of it's probably where I stand. It's like I want to like all this, but like I don't know if I do. Clemmer, what did you like the Jay Kelly trailer? Like, did it do much for you?
No, Hollywood movie star has problems isn't that interesting to me. Especially, you know, look at this year with the best movies. Just like really original, interesting ideas about mostly, you know, people that aren't incredibly wealthy, right? Like Sinners or Weapons or One Battle After Another. This George Clooney being movie star, sad movie star, I'll watch it and I'm intrigued because of Baumbach and I like Clooney a lot and I like Sandra a lot, but this is not like highly anticipated for me.
Kirk?
Yeah, it felt AI-ish to me, honestly, so far. Like, it just feels like a bunch of people kind of... I think Baumbach's in a little bit of a slump. Maybe he bounces back. I think the initial reviews weren't great, but then it got a little more momentum here in the last week or so in New York. So I hope so. I hope it's good. I love Clooney, you know, and Sam, but it just seems like... Yeah, it just feels familiar to me. It just doesn't feel interesting to me. It feels like it's going to be a miss. I hope not. I'm all in. If it's great, great, but I am not feeling it yet.
Gooch.
Yeah, same. Just echoing the same thoughts as you all. This is doing nothing for me, despite I'm a Clooney guy, even though I think his filmography kind of lacks quite a bit.
Yeah, it has
Yep.
Yeah.
What was that fucking space weird filmography movie from like around COVID?
Oh.
What was that?
Oh that's right. That
Midnight? Something Midnight?
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Project was it Project like Midnight?
I think it was Project Midnight. I think that's right. Yeah.
Bore that was.
Terrible. Yeah.
Just doing nothing for me. And it's got to think. Doing nothing for anyone, it seems like. I think there's a conversation to be had about Netflix again. I think this year they're going to get shut out once more. And I think heading into this fall season, they had what seemed like a really good slate that is turning out to be a lot of directors churning out, I think, uninspired shit, at least from initial reactions. I can speak to one of them, which I'll talk about here in a second. Catherine Bigelow's new movie, Woof. But yeah, Netflix, once again, just doesn't seem like they can figure this out.
Well, we can start with you. Just a quick things that people have seen, just give a thought or two, Max, before we move on to our ranking. You were at the New York Film Festival. What did you...
So I've seen a few things. Worst of them all would be House of Dynamite with a huge ensemble cast. Just a huge stinker. It's a very frustrating movie. The more I think about it, if you thought The Smashing Machine was unsatisfying, good Lord, this movie is just nothing, just builds towards nothing. And it's a movie about a bunch of countries nuking each other. It's crazy I don't know how that happened. Two that were very good. If I Had Legs, I Would Kick You. That is starring Rose Byrne and Conan O'Brien and A$AP Rocky from Mary Bronstein, who's a frequent collaborator with the Safdies. It has a lot of that Safdies energy. It's very visceral. I mean, it's almost like it feels like, you know, that Uncut Gems feeling where you're sitting there on edge the entire time. People are calling it Uncut Gems for Moms. I don't know if I'd go that far, but it's a good movie and I definitely recommend it. And Blue Moon, starring Ethan Hawke. He gives a very good performance. Oh, he's a dark horse, I think, for Nam. He transforms and that movie is just him in a room talking for 90 minutes and he delivers. I mean, he's one of our best. Also might be seeing the other staff. There's a situation arising tomorrow night where I have tickets to this secret screening. It could be one of two movies. Could be Marty Supreme, which would be insane.
I'm very excited to hear how Marty. I mean, that is one I if you told me it was complete ass or best picture lock, I mean, no idea where to land on that. None.
Which, hoping for that, it could also be the testament of Ann Lee, which is getting good reviews, but the gap in excitement between Marty Supreme and the testament of Ann Lee is quite large. So keep your fingers crossed for me.
Kenjack, you seen anything we haven't mentioned yet?
Not movie-wise, but Task has been really good on HBO. Really good show from the same people that made Mare of Easttown. And Peacemaker is kind of, again, we talked about it earlier, but or a couple of weeks ago or something. Just not a great season so far, but the last two episodes definitely picked up a little bit.
Clemmer?
Nothing new right now, no.
Kirk?
Well, I did see with my son Harry, we saw Friday the 13th Part 3 in 3D on October 3rd.
That's awesome.
He's a huge Friday the 13th fan, so we went to the theater. Loved it. Great franchise. Tremendous. Please bring it back. Oh, they're doing the TV show. They're doing the prequel with Linda Cardellini's playing the mom. So I'm looking forward to that. So we did see that. And I just watched. I've been trying to watch as much Robert Redford as I can. I watched All Is Lost for the first time in forever. And it's just fucking great. So
awesome.
Great in the movie. Incredible.
Awesome fucking
incredible.
Movie.
One quick last recommendation. Nebraska. For some reason, I had never seen it.
Oh, really?
I saw it last week for the first time.
Love Nebraska.
And was completely floored. It's so brilliant. Will Forte is so good. Bruce Dern's incredible. It just left me it was just a phenomenal, phenomenal movie. I know everyone's already said that. I should have seen it a long time ago, but it's definitely worth a watch.
Two Apple TV things. Actually, a couple Apple TV things real quick. The Lost Bus with Matthew McConaughey and America Ferrera, a survivalist thriller. It's not horrible.
Okay. Is that Greengrass?
Not terrible. It's nothing great.
Yeah.
But – yeah, Apple TV. It's about like the fires in California. It's kind of surprising that like McConaughey did something like that, but it's kind of neat to see him do something a little different than what he's done recently. And then just some of the shows on Apple, the Momoa show is fantastic. Slow Horses, I still think, is one of the best things on any platform, and that's back this year. And of course, if you're not watching The Morning Show, boy, are you missing out. What a pile of steaming shit that is. One of the worst things ever made. And boy, the billions of dollars Tim Cook pumps into The Morning Show on Apple TV Plus to keep that going is unbelievable. So yeah, that's that.
Oh, Kirk, I just looked up that show, by the way, just to not to derail a little bit. The guy that created that Friday the 13th series, his name is Brad Kane.
Yep.
And the biggest thing he has under his name is that he was the singing voice of Aladdin.
Okay, well,
the animated movie.
Okay, hey, don't bum me out, Ken Jack. You know,
no, maybe I'm just saying. Maybe he's been saving us his whole
that's
life.
That's true. This is his moment. This is the project of his career.
Chief Awards, my Momoa thing, by the way, I had the slip of the mind. You know what's actually I'm briefly a little excited for? I'm actually kind of excited for the Pennywise, the It series.
Yeah, that could be good.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know why. It could be terrible. Like they show the Shawshank prison bus, and I'm like, it's gross. Like, all right, we get it. Yeah. But I'm like, I don't know. I get kind of good vibes off that.
Outshine is the number one frozen fruit bar brand in America. And once you try them, it's easy to see why. Their fruit bars and mini fruit pops are made with real fruit or fruit juice using simple ingredients you can pronounce. That means no high fructose corn syrup and no artificial colors or flavors. Outshine bars are gluten-free and even a good source of vitamin C. And the flavor lineup? It's stacked. We're talking strawberry, mango, coconut, watermelon, pineapple, cherry, you name it, there's something for whatever you're craving. You've got classic fruit bars, mini fruit pops, and fruit blends that swirl multiple flavors together. Think pina colada, cherry limeade, and more. Find your new favorite refreshing snack, Outshine, at retailers nationwide.
All right, final segment here. Our last segment, we're going to do a ranking, a list, top 10 movies of 2025 so far. Here's how it works, though. Before the show, I did a random drawing of who goes first, who goes second, who goes third. So we all have two picks on the list. So one person can fuck everything up. It's a snake, a little bit of a snake. It's a snake order here. So we will start with number one. Kirk, you get the first pick. What is, and this is ours, like this is going to be on Letterboxd. You can go to Letterboxd. We're going to make a list. The Letterboxd handle is at Proj, P-R-O-J, big screen. We will have this list on there. We have to all put our fucking name on it. So this is, it's, you know, just keep that in mind. What is our number one movie of 2025 so far?
Is Wolfman this year? Or was that last year? I'm going to say Sinners is the number one movie of the year so far. I think it's for me. It is.
I'm happy that that's number one.
Yeah. For me, I mean,
is that everyone's number one?
Yeah, it's like one, that's two, or not three. Mine.
Well, Gooch must have PTA number one, right?
I do.
Yeah. That's fair. Like, Sinners, is it close?
It's number three for me.
Okay, so yeah, that's okay. I figured we kind of be in the same in the same ballpark. Speaking of rankings, real quick, I just wanted to note, Anemone I have ranked right with Alto Knights and Honey Dome. By the way, that's the perfect grouping of like boring. Like,
what if instead of Daniel Day-Lewis in the movie? The lead is whoever, you know, pick Vincent D'Onofrio. Like, is it even, does it get like a four?
Does it go to the theaters? Like,
it comes like, does it get a two?
Like, it's bad. It's bad.
That could almost be a Travolta movie, like, in like, you know, with like one action scene, like right to video.
Ken Jack, what's our number two movie of 2025 so far?
I'm kind of caught between two. I think it would be One Battle After Another. Just getting the second and third act, you could put up against anything, I think, this year. So I'm very comfortable putting that at number two for us. And I feel like we all just gloat about it, so I'm pretty comfortable with it.
That's my exact one, too, right now. It's Sinners, One Battle After Another. There's two movies this year I've given a 95 out of 100 or higher, and it's that and Sinners. Sinners is at a 97. I have the third pick. I think this is probably people's two or three as well, right around there. Maybe I'm wrong. 94 of 100 for me, Weapons is actually my actual number three, too, and is our number three on the list. Weapons was – it actually, for me, I had – a lot of people online were excited about it, but it kind of like went over my head. Like, I was like, oh, I know it's coming out. I didn't have the hype hit me. So, and that just surprised me, but I mean, people were talking like, this could be great, and it ended up being fantastic. So, yeah, mm-hmm. Weapons at three. I think we're pretty happy with that.
Yep.
Just, it's going to start to get dicey soon, I'd imagine. Clemmer, four.
Don't do it, Clemmer.
Yeah, so there's a huge drop off.
Don't do it,
Clemmer.
The top
that
three.
Fucking Chuck guy dancing. Don't do that. Don't do it.
Oh, no. All right. All right. Okay. I was convinced you guys. Life of Chuck was about to get put on this list at four.
We're not in the back end yet. I do like Life of Chuck, but no, I wouldn't do that to you guys this early, at least. I'm going to go with Caught Stealing. I really liked Caught Stealing. I thought it was the most accessible Aronofsky yet. I thought it was a blast in the theaters. I enjoyed the hell out of it. You guys. Where do you guys have Caught Stealing?
I have Caught Stealing a 49, 76 out of 100.
Fourth?
Yeah, it's not in my top 10.
Suck, Clemmer.
Gooch.
What do you want?
The movie.
I actually would rather do Life of Chuck.
Oh
no.
I don't know.
Caught Stealing. You guys didn't. You guys really didn't like Caught Stealing.
It was fine. It was fine. Yeah. It was okay. It was fine.
I liked it.
It's like an ideal Redbox movie.
No, it's not. Like it was shot really well. Stop it.
Where did I have it?
Clemmer overwhelmed the theater watching it, just overwhelmed by the movie.
I was. Had everything you want. 1998, New York, baseball is great.
If he was wearing like a fucking Jets hat, you would have been nowhere near the top. All right, wow.
Yeah, and it's Yankee Stadium instead of Shea Stadium. Yeah.
Yeah. Gooch, you have back-to-back. We'll snake it. So you have number five first.
Starting with number five, I'm glad I was able to get this in here. Don't love that it fell, but Eddington. I get where people have started to make comparisons between it and One Battle After Another, but I do think they just go about showing modern America in like very different ways outside of the Western setting. I think it's really brilliant across the board. Great act, great performances. And it's a movie that I just have continually thought about different parts ever since I left the theater for the second time. Really great stuff. I don't know if it'll stick around, but you know, I think it's a very large step up from Ari Aster's last movie and one of my favorites of the year. So you number like five, Eddington.
No. I love Eddington. Eddington's four for me. I have it at night. I love Eddington, but again, Eddington's one of those ones where would I suggest it to a mass audience? No. Because
I'm still not sure where I am on it. I need to see it again. I'm still not sure where I am.
I saw it twice. Saw back to back days. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I will say, whether you liked it or not, shout out to Ari Aster too for just trying to fucking. I mean, he makes anything.
Oh, for sure.
And to go from Hereditary to Midsommar to Beau's Afraid to this, that is like, so, and for him to make like kind of a take and viewpoint on this world in a negative, cynical way, and then you have PTA do it in a much more positive way, which we didn't really talk about that with One Battle for Another. The fact that it ends where typically so many movies like that these days end in such a negative, fucking just depressing that way. And that ends on a high note. It is a cool contrast of things that kind of a similar look on like society and stuff. So, all right.
Do you like it more your second time, Jeff? Because I'm kind of, yes. I didn't love it, but I wonder if I'm just like, the ending was like, I thought the third act was so weak, but maybe if I saw it a second time, I'd appreciate it more.
I'm not an Ari Aster apologist, but I do tend to like his movies more than I think. If you listen to our old podcast or if you follow my reviews on Letterboxd, and if not, you'll learn as we go on. Like, that type of shit is very much my bag. Like, that's what I love. So, five, Gooch. You're back to back.
Six. I know some people have soured on him, but The Phoenician Scheme, Wes Anderson's Phoenician Scheme.
No, what the fuck is wrong with you?
Phoenician Scheme.
Have you seen five movies all year?
I'm taking this name. I want my name off this list.
Cod stealing is at four. That's all right, criminal. We can deal with The Phoenician Scheme at six.
No, you can't. Phoenician Scheme stinks. No one here liked that movie.
There's no baseball in it.
I did. No baseball in it.
I actually like. To Gooch's credit, I liked it more than Caught Stealing. But yeah,
I like the one last year. I like Asteroid City. I like Asteroid City more than that one.
Agreed. I liked Asteroid City too. I think there is something happening with Wes Anderson. I get why people say he's doing the same thing over and over again, but I do think he is getting better at what he does. Like, it's like Steph Curry extending the range on a three. Like, we see him hit a million threes a season, and at some point, maybe it does get old, but I'm still impressed.
You're not bored by Wes.
That's crazy. And I fucking loved Benicio Del Toro's leading performance.
He's had a great year, that's for sure.
I really loved it.
Clemmer, bummed out by that. Seven. I'm on a run right now.
This list is over.
It's going to be Chuck or something else. Has to be.
It's my pick?
Yep.
Yeah.
No, Long Walk.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right.
Oh, make fun of me now. Oh, yeah, exactly.
I wouldn't put it that high, but yeah.
Is this? Where I thought Life with Chuck was like number one of the year.
You loved it. You were dancing around like he was.
I have Life with Chuck seventh right now. I have Present six.
Okay.
I have Black Bag eighth.
Okay. Nobody cares. All right, go ahead.
You just asked.
No, I didn't ask your eighth best movie.
You just asked. Okay. I'm telling you, I'm giving you a little bearing.
Since we've veered off the path so much, I was between two here. One I won't say because I think it might drop in the list, but I'm going to go with one of my five movies that I put in 90 or 100, 90 or above. I also realize that this is not for everyone, not everyone's sense of humor, but I fucking love it, and that is Friendship with Tim Robinson and Paul Rudd. I love this movie, and it's also – shout out to this movie too because – it's picking up some like culty steam already too. Just that garage scene, the extended cut of that garage scene is one of the funniest fucking things I've ever watched. I love this movie. He's in Gin Pop. Also, the best thing of that garage scene is there's one picture on the wall in that garage, and it's the picture of the Situation Room when they're watching Osama bin Laden. It's a small printout of that picture. I love it. I get it. And Tim Robinson, not for everybody, but I love the mix of this being a super like serious like buddy movie, but also the ridiculousness of Tim Robinson. So yeah, I'm gonna put Friendship at number eight. I love that.
I have this 11th. I really like this movie a lot. That's a great pick.
Yeah. I had fears of, as a gigantic Tim and Eric fan, I had a lot of fears this would be Tim and Eric. Tim and Eric's billion dollar movie has a lot of funny moments, but even as a big fan, I admit it's one of the dumbest things ever made. I was worried that that's what it'd be, and Friendship was not that. So Ken Jack, number nine.
This is a movie I have high, but it's weird because like it's not a very rewatchable movie, but I don't think you can really factor that in too much. But I loved Warfare. I think Warfare is one of the most like
that was my other one. That's what I'm glad I didn't say it. Yep.
Yeah, it's one of those like horrifying war movies I think I've ever watched. Like, and it was so like grounded in realism, and like I love the depiction of it because like typically you know you have like ebbs and flows, like you're getting character development, like and this really just isn't that. You're just stuck with these guys for 24 hours in absolute hell. And like you feel it come across through the action versus hearing people say shit out loud. I loved it. The whole cast, which was like, that grouping was insane. Like all like teeny bopper TikTok guys, but they all crushed it. Every single one of them top to bottom. And a guy we love, Cosmo Jarvis, I thought particularly was excellent. So really liked it. Not a movie I think I'll ever rewatch because it's so heavy. But man, it's good. And, you know, Garland, I think combining with a real Navy SEAL to depict that, I think it was a really cool combination. And I really loved it.
I've been surprised by the amount of people who have seen that, who I expected to not love it, who said they've really enjoyed that movie.
Yeah, it was good. Very good.
Very different. Alex Garland is he's a fucking good filmmaker. Yeah, Warfare was another A24 movie. Really solid movie.
So much better than Civil War. I thought Civil War was
so much better.
I'm not a huge Civil War. I think, Gooch, I know you like Civil War. I was the same thing with Civil War. I liked this better than Civil War. Yeah.
Civil War is so predictable. You just knew it was going to happen. I just you're kind of
weird. Yeah, but that Sturgill Simpson needle drop was so cool.
That one one song. That's all 100 points.
That was great.
Kirk, number 10, rounded out.
Wait, right, you took the photos of the motherfucking Antifa, right?
I'm willing to be collaborative here. I have between three movies, Megadoc, Black Bag, and the movie I really liked, Predator, Killer of Killers, the Predator movie from this year, which I really liked. So Clemmer, which one would you pick of those three?
I've only seen one of those movies. I've only seen Black Bag.
Okay. Did you guys see the Predator movie?
Predator's awesome.
It was
awesome,
great, right?
Yep.
Dude, that franchise is fucking back. Apparently the new one with Elle Fanning is also very good.
Coming out in
2 weeks.
I'll put that at number 10.
I like that.
I like that too.
Black Bag would have made sense as well.
Black Bag is great. It's awesome. Great. Yeah.
So our list. So that's on Hulu. Predator Killers or Killers, if you haven't seen it. Awesome animated movie. Talk about a franchise that fits animation perfectly. Mm-hmm. Like, just awesome. Number 10, Predator Killers or Killers. Number 9, Warfare. Number 8, Friendship. Number 7, The Long Walk. Number 6, The Phoenician Scheme. Number 5, Eddington. Number 4, Caught Stealing. Number 3, Weapons. Number 2, One Battle After Another. Number 1, Sinners. The combined list is going to be good. This is going to get really contentious as we move. Because there's a lot to pick from here. Next week, we're doing most anticipated. But when we go forward, we're picking, like, you know, best. Yeah, I was, of course, like, it's, it, yeah, this is the combined.
So, Clemmer, if Caught Stealing won Best Picture, you'd be like, that makes sense.
Would you all like to hear?
Aronofsky gets his bouquet. I will say a huge drop off after the top three. So I wouldn't say it makes sense, but I wouldn't.
I don't know if I agree with that.
Black Bag is much better movie than Caught Stealing, Clemmer.
Oh, I enjoyed Caught Stealing more. I think Black Bag, but, like, now we're arguing, like, very good movies. Like, they're both in the same tier.
No, they're not. Whatever. They're not.
For me, they are. Yeah, for me, they're, like, the same tier. I think those top three, though, are, like, quite a bit above everything else.
Would you like to hear our fan rankings, where our fans stand for the top 10 on the year? All right. At number 10, we have Friendship. Number 9, 28 Years Later. Number 8.
Yeah, I like that.
Number 8, Warfare. Number 7, Ephes.
Clemmer, you haven't seen Ephes?
No.
What?
I did the screening of that, remember?
What?
Clemmer, stop going to these fucking stupid movies because they're
Gabby's Dollhouse. You saw Gabby's Dollhouse.
Yeah, I did. It's in 1,000 screens. It was terrible.
Taylor Swift
dot. It's a base. Ephes is, like, made for you. Like,
the guy who made Ephes, the guy who made Ephes probably dedicated the movie to you.
Like, it's literally made for just you.
Sounds wonderful.
Nobody else. You haven't seen it yet?
No, I gotta see it.
That's crazy.
Go ahead, Gooch.
Number 6, F1. Number 5, Superman, which surprised me a bit. Number 4, Sorry Baby. Number 3, Weapons. Number 2, Sinners. And number 1, One Battle After Another.
Okay. I wonder if that's recency, but that does make sense. I've seen it. It's kind of the top for a lot of people. So yeah, it's a good list.
If you want to be part of our fan rankings, together. By the way.
It was the saltiest popcorn of all time in Watertown, Massachusetts.
Clemmer picked an awful theater. Terrible.
We had a great experience. It was just buddies hanging out. It was a good time.
What were you saying, Gooch?
I was just going to add one note. If you want to be part of our fan rankings, it's just a follow from us on our Letterbox.
Yep.
Comment on this YouTube video or Spotify or wherever you're listening, and drop your favorite quote from One Battle After Another or something. Yep. And then leave your Letterbox username. I will follow you.
Definitely follow us on Letterboxd. We're going to be very active on there. Kirk, we just had you join. We're all on there. The names are below. Like I said, you can find them. Go give us a follow. Other ones from the year, by the way, because Superman, I think a lot of us enjoyed Superman. Bring Her Back, Naked Gun. There's some. Oh, you know, it's another one. I'm going to tell you one quick before we go. I was thinking about this today in the car. You know what's a Oscar battle? Maybe not as interesting as Best Picture or an actor race, but I actually think it's a very intriguing, like, what the fuck would win. Is Best Original Song this year. because the front runners for that are kind of from the same space. You're going to have Cynthia Erivo's original song from the new Wicked movie. You're going to have Ariana Grande's original song. That alone is, like, I think, pretty interesting if you're a fan of the Oscars. But then you have these three fucking songs from K-pop Demon Hunters. No. You have Golden, which has been number one in the for 15 weeks. That is, like, that is as close of a, like, what the fuck could win as any category I think I've seen in a while. Like, I actually have no idea what went out of that, because I'm assuming the two songs from Wicked are going to be well received. Like, you just have to assume that that's likely going to happen. That's a very interesting battle.
Does it go to Warren? We'll have some song that we've never seen.
Oh, like, yeah,
whatever movie she did this year. They're playing this K-pop demon at, like, college football games. These songs, yeah. Like, yeah, people just
did they play it? You went here to Penn State, and did they play it at the Penn State?
They might have. I don't know, honestly, but they might have. There are songs I didn't know, so probably.
They played at stadiums. It is crazy how big that movie has been. And I hope it's Netflix being like, oh, maybe we should put movies in theaters a little longer.
Yeah.
Huh. Maybe is there any space for something from, like, Ballad of Wallace Island, which is a movie I really liked, like, to have an original song, or it's going to get squeezed out by K-pop Demon Hunters for, like, original song? Because some of the music in there I thought was great.
It could get a nom. They're weird because it's an older, you know, like, Diane Warren gets nominated every year.
What shit movie did she make a song for this?
We even know it. What? Remember the Cheetos
what
movie?
What Angel Studio movie did she? You know, she makes songs for knockoff Angel Studio movies.
Michael Chiklis says sing a song in this movie? Did he,
Hell yeah.
I don't know.
Fucking the
Ballad of the Senior?
Yeah, I don't know.
So next week, so we're always going to do these little reviews in between. We had our old podcast. I'll stop referencing the old podcast after a while. Don't worry. But I think Ken Jack, we always hit that point where, like, I feel like we have to catch up on reviews. So we're going to make sure that we, you know, just because we hit something in the middle section doesn't mean we won't expand on it further. Like, when Frankenstein comes out in a few weeks, it's not going to be in many theaters. We'll talk about it very briefly when it hits Netflix. We'll talk about it larger. But the main review next week, a franchise people are banging down the door to get back on the big screen. Oh. Tron Ares next week will be our main review, which we'll see. This might age poorly. We'll see. Our ranking next week, by the way, is most anticipated for the rest of the year, which I'm excited about. We'll see if this ages poorly, but don't you just love that awesome world in Tron in the video game and how cool and vibrant it looks? Now, what if it was just, instead of that, the real world? Like, what the fuck? What's the point of that?
Let's get, like, Frodo Baggins in Detroit. Like, what's the fucking idea here? I truly don't get it.
I don't know what this movie's tracking for right now. I'm sure, Clemmer, you know, but I would take the under. Hammer the under.
Zero.
They have, like, you can tell they've completely thrown their hands up on marketing this, because now they just are like, the Nine Inch Nails did the soundtrack. Like, that's what their trailers are now. They're like,
seeing that ad with Jeff Bridges be like, Nine Inch Nails, guys. It's like, I don't think you know what Nine Inch Nails are.
There's just zero buzz.
None.
Like, in fact, when you said, when you kind of set out that thing on Twitter saying what movies we have coming up, I forgot it was coming out next week.
It's tracking for 44, they said, but this is also like 2-3 weeks ago.
I take the under on that. Big
yeah,
time.
Me too.
Oh my gosh.
Feeling lucky? You should be. Meet the new Lucky One Sweet Tea from Miss Peaches, the vodka drink that's positively doing good. Made with real tea and real vodka, non-carbonated, 100 calories. And here's the scoop. Their new sweet tea is the only vodka-based sweet tea on the market. Simple ingredients in a smooth, full flavor that makes it taste just like the real sweet tea. Best part? Every can helps rescue dogs find their forever homes as they work to a goal of donating $1 million to dog rescues in 2026. So if you love true sweet tea, this one's a no-brainer. Pick up a Lucky One Sweet Tea today and give back one can at a time.
All right, before we wrap up this podcast, speaking of The Smashing Machine, Gooch sat down with the director of The Smashing Machine, Benny Safdie. Here's that interview.
All right, we are now joined by Benny Safdie, director, writer, editor, producer of The Smashing Machine, the story of mixed martial artist and UFC champion Mark Kerr.
That's right.
Now, that is a very short synopsis I pulled right off Letterboxd, but can I get a pitch from you?
Okay. Well, I wanted to make a movie what it felt like to be him. Mm-hmm. Truly, I wanted the audience to feel like, what is it like to be a fighter? What do they go through, everything that they feel? And I wanted to make his memories your memories.
Looking through your filmography, it's very clear that you love sports. I mean, Lenny Cook, Uncut Gems, more recently, Happy Gilmore 2, which I know you grew up loving that movie.
Oh, my God. Idolizing.
What drew you to the world of MMA?
Well, it's I remember going in 2002 with my stepfather to see like one of the first UFC fights that like I guess after it had just kind of been sold.
Yep.
So I saw it in 2002 in Connecticut. But before that, watching it on pay-per-view and just like these like really there was something really exciting about it. It was it was like bloody and gory. Yeah. But there was just something really almost experimental early on. And I've always loved boxing. You know, I've always loved boxing and just combat sports in general, and I've done some boxing, you know, personally. I was going to play a boxer in something, so I was like, if I'm going to play a boxer, I got to do this. And so I went to a boxing gym, and then like 10 years go by because the thing never happened. But I became close, and I really loved the sport, and I just the biggest thing for me was you walk into this gym, and you feel like you're going to look like a complete asshole. Like, I can curse and stuff, right? Or not?
Yeah, please,
okay.
Curse.
Okay. You look like, I think I'm going to look like a complete asshole. Like, don't know how to throw a punch. I'm going to look really stupid. But I really wanted to learn. And you go in there, and if you really want to learn, they're going to take you in, and they're going to help you, you know? And it was just such a kind of loving, inclusive place. And I thought, nobody knows that, you know? Nobody knows that about this world. And you get really close, and you sparring, and somebody knocks you out, and you're like, thank you, man. It's like, that's the greatest thing in the world. And so I just kind of became obsessed with that idea of this brotherhood of that. And specifically like early MMA, you see them pop up on your feed and you're just like, this stuff looks awesome. Mm-hmm. The ring, there's Pancras, which is like green. Yep. You know, Boz Rutten, just like he said something amazing to me. He goes, I won all my fights in the first round. And he's like, because it was only one round, 30 minutes. And you just think, my God, early on, these things were just like, endurance, like round robins where you're fighting five guys in one night. And just the fact that, like, I know you maybe you've seen that, like, I forget who he's fighting, but the Don Fry fight where it's just like punch, 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 punch. They go, they're just destroying one another. And at the very end, it's like he doesn't get up and fucking put his hands up in the air. He just pats the guy on the chest like, we did that. Yeah. You know, there's something awesome about that part of it. And in sports in general, you can use it to understand your life, you know?
Yeah, no, so. It's definitely like as close as you can get to like real life drama.
Yeah. Yeah, no. And it's like the highest stakes, you know, and it's so clear cut. And, and yeah, that's just like, and yeah, there's just something about like two people facing one another and then just trying to understand like what that feels like, you know?
Mm-hmm. Now the stars, obviously, The Rock.
Yeah.
Pretty big name. Yeah. There's a great story about how you ended up with linking up with Robert Pattinson on Good Time. He had seen a frame from Heaven Can Wait, and he said...
Heaven Knows What. Heaven Can Wait is a great, great movie, though. And totally okay, because it's a great movie in its own right.
Heaven Knows What. Mm-hmm. Go watch it. Beautiful film. Is there a story behind how you ended up linking up with The Rock?
So he reached out like in 2019 about wanting to make this movie. You know, and as soon as I saw the documentary and I saw Mark Kerr, I was just like, I just kind of fell in love with him. Mm-hmm. You know, he's this soft-spoken, gentle guy who can go in the ring and just destroy. And yet then he would come out and you try and explain himself, what his emotions were, what his feelings were. And I'm like, this guy is the most beautiful contradiction I've ever seen. And there was something about also just like, he's going through so much in his life, and yet he comes out and he puts on this face for the crowd. He smiles, you know? And I could relate to that, you know? Sometimes having to put yourself behind for other people. And I knew Dwayne can relate to that. And I just kind of got him. Because you have this image of him in your head. And then when I met him, it was just like, oh my God, this guy is so deep and beautiful and sweet. And everything just made sense, you know? And things kind of just drifted apart. COVID happens. And I remembered thinking like, oh, I don't know what's going to happen with this thing. So I went online. There's a very specific yellow Nautica sweater that he wears in the documentary. And it just stuck in my head. And I had a screen grab on my phone from 2020. I was just looking at it. And I just would always look at it and think, oh, you know, there was something that I needed to do with him on this thing. And I found a version of the sweater in XXXL, which was like a miracle. And I sent it to him, and I wrote it a handwritten letter saying, like, you know what, if whenever this happens, if I'm a part of it, if not, whatever, I just want you to wear this thing. Mm-hmm. Put it on, and just it'll help you hopefully become Mark in some little way. But I wrote it in my handwriting, and my handwriting's like a psychotic second grader. And it looks terrible. So I'm sure somebody in his group got this like package, and they're like, let's just not mention this. And then you fast forward to Emily Blunt. I'm working with her on Oppenheimer. And I was like, you know what? What's going on with that thing? You know, I haven't stopped thinking about it. I show her the picture. And, you know, then we just hooked up and we just decided, you know, let's just do it, you know. It's this thing I hadn't stopped thinking about for 4 years. So let's just go for it.
It does feel like a role that is tailor-made for Dwayne.
Yeah.
But I do think whenever you have someone that is that recognizable, it presents some challenges.
For sure.
So what was the process in making sure that, you know, hair and makeup, and what were you doing to make sure that when we watch this movie, we see Mark Kerr and not Dwayne The Rock Johnson?
Well, and I think part of it was he wanted to disappear too. Mm-hmm. You know, he wanted the ability to kind of, specifically with the things he was going to talk about and explore, he wanted to feel like he could do that. And working with Kazu, who is one of the greatest makeup artists in the world, you know, ever, we kind of had these three phases of makeup. We could do a full reconstruction and make him look exactly like Mark Kerr, or we could kind of find a balance. And part of it was like, there's going to be a lot of movement. I don't want to do special effects. I want to have this on his face while he's fighting. And I said to Dwayne, too, I want you in there doing this stuff. And he's like, okay. And so he's getting his face mashed around, and this stuff had to be on there. And so we settled on one where I was like, I need Dwayne to shine through too, because this is his story also. You know, I said to Mark early on, like, you lived your life so we could all feel it. And so there's going to be things in this that we're all exploring and we all want to look at. And so I wanted parts of Dwayne to come through too. Mm-hmm. It needed to be kind of a mix of the two of them. And so we found this like perfect balance. And then Mia Neal, who did the wig, you know, that was something that was just so we were really like thinking about like different things. And you know, sometimes it's thinning, sometimes this is covering up, you know, wanted that to feel real. Cause on The Curse, I remember when I had a wig on, I was like, I gotta be in the water because if you're in the water, then like that things kind of just, you forget, there's little things that you can kind of do that make you forget about that. So sometimes it's messy. Sometimes it's gelled. Sometimes it's this, sometimes it's when you wake up, it looks a different way, you know? I'm always trying to figure something out. You know, it's
no, like, the wig was very impressive because I've never seen a wig where it's thinning and then you can see the beaded sweat like underneath the thinning hair, which is like a very unique look.
And what we really settled on was with Kazu was this, just the brow and the nose and the ear, cauliflower ear. Yes. And then we also talked about how after a fight, these things swell. Mm-hmm. So we had prosthetics for after fights, right after, 12 hours later, just different levels of all of that. So, but it was a very, Dwayne had to be in makeup for like 3-4 hours a day. You know, just because it was this, it's not necessarily the pieces, it's the fact that they're so delicately and like applied and the seams disappear. And, you know, like we, Kazu and I, like obsessed over the eyebrows, you know, because if the eyebrows were a specific way, they highlight the eyes one way. If they're too sharp in one way, then it's a different face. And it was just really important also that, like, when I said to Dwayne, like, because as an actor, I've worn prosthetics before. And you want to feel comfortable doing your normal things. And I was like, how do you feel? He's like, I feel like myself. And I'm like, that's perfect, you know?
I'd also like to pivot to the action or the fighting within the movie. I would say that it's very unique compared to, you know, what we're used to, the usual fare of the Rocky movies. You usually see it's very center, it's up close, big booming score. This is a lot of off-center with a very nice kind of jazzy score underneath of it.
Nala Sinéfro, she's the best.
Was that a decision and where that's something you wanted to do, or did you really want to differentiate yourself there?
It was a decision. It's something I wanted to do, and I also, like, I did want to kind of figure out my own way, you know, because you see all these amazing movies, and they're great, and I'm like, all right, if I'm going to be even like a little fraction, just like a little dust of one of those, I want to find a way to do something that kind of makes it feel different. And I remember watching some of the MMA fights with the sound off and just kind of seeing how they were covered. And I was like, oh, wait, And I also wanted to really make these punches feel real, you know, because like nowadays, if you get in there, there's so much trickery going on that like it kind of like it doesn't mean anything. And so I'm like, I want you to like try and want to get. I said to Maceo, we have third tier passes. So I purposely held everybody back. I told all the extras, do not give a shit about us. Get in our way. We have to make our way through to find you. And so we only stay outside the ring. It was a rule. Don't go in the ring. It's not. We're not allowed in there. That's for the fighters. And I wanted to give the audience a first row seat, basically. The best seat in the house. But you're not in there with them. So we have to feel it.
Yes.
And where you are in there with them is all the stuff after before that. You know, all the emotions that they're going through. You're connected that way. And so even though you're distant, you can still feel close because you know the guy, you know. But I really wanted to kind of – and we had these crazy moves planned because it's like for the most part, they're not actually getting punched in the face.
Yeah.
Dwayne did get punched.
Oh,
you know,
really?
And he said, I have to early on because there's one really like brutal fight that Kerr was in. And he's like, there's no other way we're going to be able to do it. And he said to the guy, he goes, you got to hit me. You have to hit me. And he's like, I'm not going to do it. He goes, just you know where to hit me where you don't like mess me up. But you got to punch me in the face.
Is this the fight with Alexander? Where he took
It was it's with Fujita.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Sorry. Fujita, he's just getting punched and kneed in the stomach. And it's just, it's insane. It's just intense. And that, he's like, I just got to get rocked. Pun intended. But it's like.
I was waiting for it.
So basically like, so in the sense, but we would be like, all right, so we're going to have the camera here. And we know that we need to kind of hide this stuff. So we'll run down, act like you're getting a better shot, and we'll pan through. And so it would end up learning. We would shoot all the fights with all with Greg Rementer, the stunt coordinator, who did an incredible job, you know, figuring out how to get these things. And he knew I didn't want to do special effects. He knew I wanted to get as much as possible in camera. And we did it in camera. So he's like, all right, so if we can put him here, and if you're tell me where your camera's going to be, we would shoot them all, and then I would edit them. And then I would be like, okay, this is great. Let's add another punch here, another kick there. And then I would edit them again. And there was one amazing day where we had – I had the whole office come down. We gave them all cameras, and we shot the fight in downstairs in the ring where we – that's where our workshop was. And then I edited that together to see if it was going to work, you know. And, then we just – it also allowed me to just like when we got there to do these things. It's physical. They're grappling. They're getting thrown on the ground. Like, that stuff you can't fake, you know? You can give extra padding and stuff. And it's like if the camera's here, it's like and then he hands down, then he's like, oh, he's blocking it. But those first ones with the sound design, you can make it just really – that was really – the sound design was intense. Just – I wanted you to – because that's how you can get close, is hearing the punches.
Yeah.
And it was not just the punch. I wanted to hear the – sounds after the punch, the skin, the bone, you know, like we really were. So you look at one of these punches and there's like 10 sounds. And it was funny. I remember watching, I took a sound design class in college and the guy showed us, and you can find it online, but there's a, it's the Terminator 2 special feature sound design. And they go like, first one, like pistol. Then it's like shotgun. Then it's like cannon, boom, and then they add all these other stuff, and then they show you the final sound, and it's like, boom, and you're just like, oh my God, that's how you do that.
Yes.
And so we really spent a lot of time trying to figure out how they were, the perfect noises. They're never the same. They're always a little different, and so you can bring it in closer that way. But we never went in the ring, you know, and I wanted it to feel like, oh, this is the best seat in the house. And I'll never be able to get another point of view. And when you see it on a giant screen, it's just cool.
After every single fight, I was drained.
Yeah, you know? And it's also, that's the other thing is mixed martial arts, there's something to it where it's so fast. It's like bang, bang, bang. It's like everything happens. I said to Greg, I said, I need to know what a takedown feels like. So take me down. And so he's like, you sure? I said, yeah. Next thing you know, bang. I'm like, oh, my God. It just happens.
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, I need to capture that energy. And then Nala's like, okay, she saw the jazz. Like, I had free jazz drums, and she's like, no, it's got to be in time. And so we should put in jazz over this stuff and the drum and saxophone and electric guitar, like figuring out all this stuff that we can do that kind of mirrors his emotional state as opposed to just kind of like pumping you up. So yeah, it was fun.
I was blown away by the production value throughout this movie, and specifically the time period. You really nailed, you know, yeah, that late 90s, early 2000s time period in two different locations, which feels like a big challenge. And
yeah,
can I ask you what your experience was like shooting in Japan? I mean,
shooting in Japan is unbelievable. You know, it's just, it's amazing because like it's a totally different society. Mm-hmm. And yet, so there's all these different rules and things that you have to kind of work with. And, but like to get that period, it's weird because it's a long time ago.
Yeah.
And you don't realize it, but like, that's like,
try not to think about it.
Yeah, I don't want to think about it because it scares me every time. I'm like, it's yesterday, right? Yeah. And it's like, no. And so so there's the clothes, you know, that like that Heidi, we wanted them to have a certain level of wornness to it. Because one thing I realized is it's not the 90s. Mm-hmm. It's the late 90s. So all of your 90s shirts have to have a specific quality to it that they've mm-hmm. been worn, washed. And that they flow a different way. They hide your thing. They just drape specifically. Mm-hmm. The things needed to feel lived in a certain way. It was like I would obsess over like the scratches on the wall in yes. the house.
The house, you know, was brilliant.
Which was set.
The furniture.
That's a set. We built a house on a stage because part of it was I knew I needed these specific shots for mm-hmm. one of those fights that I wanted the cameras to feel hidden. I didn't want the actors to see them. So we built the house for that, wow. you know? And just, but all the stuff, it's like there's these weird ineffable things that make something feel real. You know, it's not quite clean. Mm-hmm. And so, and then also we knew that like 16 millimeter, that the lenses we were using were going to add to that, mm-hmm. you know, add to that kind of, it's a nostalgia in a way, but it's not like precious, you know? So I'm glad that you picked up on that because that feeling is something that you work hard to get and you don't know if it's going to land, mm-hmm. But shooting in Japan was just like, yeah, it was amazing. Because like, I remember there was this one thing where we had to stop this like market. Mm-hmm. And it's when Emily is coming and she's mm-hmm. so excited to be in Japan. And they're just like, we don't close streets here. And I'm like, I just need 45 seconds. That's it. Because I needed to have a bunch of people yeah. wearing the period clothes,
oh, yeah.
cell phones, all that
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, I saw someone with the, yeah. with the flip phone.
And it's like I yes. needed that, and I couldn't have – because the moment somebody entered in, you realized, oh, my God, it was depressing because, like, wow, things have changed a ton. But, like, the moment somebody entered in, you're like, I can't have that. And so I said, just 45 seconds, please. And they're like, okay, fine. And we found, like, the 4 points of entrance. And we just did it. You know, we shut it down. We got mm-hmm. it. And – It was just fun, you know. It was nice to have that energy over there, and everybody was such a pleasure to work with, and they were so happy, you know. To, yeah. you know, there's one thing that we didn't shoot. It's in this like temple. We shot it, but it's not in the movie, and it was amazing because it was this really small town, and while we're shooting the scene, the entire town was there, and it was just the most incredible thing. And the guy was the mayor, and there's this thing that they do. Like when they welcome you, there's he gave me this watermelon, and they put the watermelon in the middle of this square, and they give you like one of these like wooden swords, and they blindfold you, and everybody yells to you where to go. It's like pinata.
Yeah, I was about to say this sounds like a Japanese.
It's a Japanese pinata, but with a watermelon, and I'm doing it and this, and I'm hearing all these voices, and I'm like, you know, I'm gonna listen to Maseo because he's a cinematographer. Yeah. We're tied to the hip. I'm listening to him, so he's telling me exactly where to go, and I just go. Whack, and everybody starts clapping, and I take off the blindfold, and the thing is like broken mm-hmm. apart, and it's just like a good luck thing. And yep. then you just are supposed to reach in and grab a piece and bite it. Yeah. And there's all these just beautiful like ceremonies, you know, for these little things. And it was nice to have that around, you know.
Yeah, no, wouldn't get that here.
No, you get the other things here, though.
Yeah, like, yeah, you get a lot of things. Yeah, horns constantly blaring, at least yeah. here in this studio.
That's, and it's funny because I specifically in the sound, you, when you watch the movie, I put in, and we were so specific. I was like, I need a plane to go over the house. Mm-hmm. I just need a plane. I want to hear a plane going over the house. And you hear that like low, yes. just like going over. And it happens at the same time at different moments.
Yeah.
And I need to hear a leaf blower 5 things away. And I'm adding all the stuff that you try and get rid of.
That's what makes it feel real.
Yeah.
Makes it feel like you're there.
Yeah.
Back to filming. You shot this on 60mm. Yeah. There's a great photo of you in the grocery store with the big IMAX camera on your shoulder.
Yes.
First time using that technology for
you? It was the first time physically using that technology. I had worked on it, you know, Oppenheimer and then the Odyssey and just like seeing what he's doing with this thing.
Did you reach out to him for help? I know Coogler had spoken about, you know.
Yeah, we talk, you know, and it was just like, it was exciting. Like, you know, I was asking him like, and I just kind of saw what it did on set, you know, that camera, just and how it was amazing. Like the way that he's treating that camera is like, and moving with it is wild. Mm-hmm. And it was just incredible to see. And so I was like, oh, I want to try something with this camera, you know, we ended up finding there's a specific moment in the movie when we use it, but it's an important thing because the movie transitions from like YouTube, to 16mm to like IMAX, you know, and you have this journey, but it's all for IMAX, you know. Yep. We met with them beforehand and talked about like, how can we get this to look okay on an IMAX screen? Cause it's never been done before. You know, there's never been a 16mm movie on an IMAX screen. So it's like, how do we figure this out? And so we did all these tests with degraining and this, and we like, okay, if we pull back a little bit on our lenses on the handheld, we can smooth it out. So it was really shot with that idea. And one of the things I'm very excited is like, there's going to be a VHS on IMAX, which is cool. But because I wanted it to be like, you're discovering, that's how a lot of this happens, you know, nowadays is you swipe on your phone and you see this image and you're like, oh my God, who's that? And then you go and you learn about them. So I wanted that to be a part of the process of the movie. Like, here's this incredible fight in Brazil. Like, and they're just watching it like you would find it on YouTube. And it's just there. And then it's like, I want to know more about that guy. Bam. Now we're going to find out, you know.
Now, before we started this interview, you were about to dive into a story from the Odyssey set, I believe.
It was just because I was saying we were in Morocco. Yes. And I was going around with, I was like, I wanted to see the place. And so my day off, I went around with, I asked this guy, I was like, hey, can you take me around to some of the things? And I ate the food, I drank the things. And then I like remember talking to Chris being like, the water, like, what's that like here? And he's like, you don't drink it. And I'm like, and then it was just like, I was like, in my head, I'm like, I saw the moment. And I'm like, oh, that's going to be a thing. And then I remember just like going to the doctor or them putting the stethoscope on my stomach. And they just went like, whoa, something's going on in there. And then I had to go back and I was more prepared.
Good shoot, right?
Oh, it was incredible. It was just I was saying the scale of it, you wouldn't believe me if I told you. And just, I just love being on his set and just learning, you know, it's great. And it's just, it's just wild.
It is wild. I mean, you're a frequent collaborator now.
I think
you can say that. did you expect, by the way, from Oppenheimer, did you expect Until They Build a Bigger Bomb to become the meme that it has?
I know. That's the thing that I had no idea. Somebody sent that to me and I'm just like, oh, I guess that's a thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, it's very much a thing.
And it's like, and it's just so funny because like, it's just that like, because when it's happening, you have no idea. All I'm thinking about is I got this accent that I got to do, and I'm trying to like be realistic in this thing. And so you just do it, and it's like, oh yeah, until you build a bigger bomb.
It's a great line.
It's a great line. It's a
fantastic.
You know, and it's like I'm just trying to do justice to it, and it's just so funny that like it became this thing, and you never know what's going to happen, but I love it, you know, because I had such a good time.
Yeah.
On that, you know, it was just like working on that with everybody there, and it was just so like it's just funny to see that face, and I can like go right back to that moment in the desert, you know, probably I don't know 6 miles away from where they actually did the test, you know, with Killian, just thinking, how am I going to deliver this thing? Yeah.
Not to stay too much on the internet, but I don't know if you saw this, a tweet went viral last week. And it's just a picture of you promoting Daddy Long Legs outside the IFC Center, right next to you, looking glamorous.
Oh, wow.
On the Venice red carpet.
That is killer.
What
that
would
is
you,
killer.
Which, If you're ever in New York, go to the IFC Center. It's the quintessential New York movie experience, in my opinion.
It's like an independent multiplex.
Yes. How would you say you've grown the most since that picture? As a filmmaker, at least.
Well, the thing is I part of me wants to feel like I've learned a lot of how to do stuff, but part of me likes to think that I haven't changed that much, hopefully, from that first photo, because, like, no joke, when we did our tech check in Venice, and then on my way out, I see everybody going in, and my initial reaction is, hey, go enjoy. I'm like, and I stood outside and I said hello to everybody, because I was just like, I wanted to like see if they were going to have a good time, you know, go in and enjoy it. And they're like, whoa, what are you doing standing out here? So it basically was the same thing. You know, nobody took a picture there, but it was just like, that was a moment where I was just like, okay, it's the first movie. All I wanted was for it to be held over. That's it. I just wanted to make it to the next weekend. And so printed out this sign, all these flyers, and I just stood outside all day for 9 hours convincing people not to go to other movies and to go to this one. And they're like, well, who are you telling me this? I'm like, well, I made that with my brother, you know? It's like, they're like, what? And you're standing out here, and everybody at the theater thought, oh, this is cute. But then when I came back the next day, and I was also there all day for 9 hours standing, they're like, oh, he's not messing around. He's really, this is a real promotion thing that he's doing. So, I think it's amazing, you know, that like, to go from that to being there. But like, I hope not too much has changed. You know?
I mean, listen, the gondolas and the Aperol spirits, they have nothing on a slice of Joe's pizza.
Oh, yeah, come for on, sure. Come
on. Can't beat that.
No, you can't beat that. Although their pizza is pretty good over there. It's just different.
So before you get out of here, I would like to really quickly, usually we'll go through and do a full ranking, but we're just going to do a quick draft. A favorite director is working right now.
Oh, fuck.
I know. It's tough.
I could go PTA, Chris Nolan.
Okay.
You know?
I mean, I would have led off with PTA, so you took him off my board.
Okay.
PTA and Nolan, right at the top. Wow. I'd go Scorsese.
Oh, next. For sure.
I mean.
No, but that's the, Scorsese. You don't.
Yeah.
It's amazing that he's still going.
Yes.
And he's making things at such a high level. Scorsese, done. Yes. Scorsese. Man, this is too hard.
Next on my list would be Park Chan-wook.
Okay,
I think is just that's a good brilliant.
One. It's just so funny because it's like I there's so many. There's so many people.
I started to write a list and then it just like I had to stop myself at some point. I got like 20 names in. I was like, we're not going to.
Can I just like not go? Because it's like there's certain like I don't want anybody to be like, oh,
why'd you leave me off?
Yeah, why'd you leave me off?
How about this? Who's one director you really want to work with as an actor?
Oh, well, you got Spielberg.
Okay.
You know, that's another guy who's still going.
Can't wait for his UFO movie.
Yeah.
I'm ready for it.
And then, fuck. Let's see. What else? Who else is there? I'm thinking like, there's so many else. Mike Lee.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, Mike Lee. There's Yeah, there's too many.
There's honestly,
Herzog, Werner Herzog.
Oh,
come on.
Incredible.
Now it's all like coming back to me. So there's no particular order here. You know, and then there's a new movie, Ross McKelvey, he made a documentary, Sherman's March, with big influence. But yeah, there's so many. It's not fair. I don't like this draft.
You don't like this draft?
Because it's like
throw it out.
Yeah. I want, it's just like
fire the person who came up with this idea.
it's the kind of thing where I'm just like, I get so overwhelmed in my head about like, okay, what's going with it, blah, blah, blah. And then it's like, you lose these, I don't know. There's too many. But then, it's endless. You know, you have like Cuarón, Del Toro, you got, and then you
the
have
Amigos, of course.
It's exactly. So there's just, it's an amazing kind of moment just to be watching movies, you know, that like, there's just such a,
there's a wealth of just great deep bench. Filmmakers right now.
It's a deep bench.
You're on that list.
Oh no.
First.
Yeah.
Definitely. So Smashing Machine, October 3rd.
Yeah.
Definitely go see it. Saw it last night. Enjoyed it quite a bit.
Thank you, man. I appreciate that.
This has been an honor.
Yeah. This has been great. So fun.
All right. Thank you.
Cool.
that's it for this first episode. Thank you for episode. Ooh, nice little lisp at the end there. Almost made it through. Like and subscribe wherever you're listening or watching. Follow us on all social platforms at Proj, P-R-O-J. Big screen. Shout out to those guys who had at Big Screen who didn't get back to us on the DMs. Fucking assholes. Of course, Letterboxd as well. Go find us. Interact with us on all of our reviews. We'll be putting things up there. And lists, all that and much more. Maybe if you're like a physical media reviews at some point. That's it. For Kirk, Ken Jack, Clemmer, Gooch, I'm Jeff D'Lo. We will talk to you next week.